Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner wird präsentiert von Bet at Home, dem offiziellen Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League. Hol dir jetzt deinen Eishockey-Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Unsere Liga, dein Spiel.
Achtung! Was für ein Move! Nächste Chance! Was für ein Pass zur Mitte! 1-0! Und der nächste Fight am Eis entbrennt! Hier entladen sich die Emotionen! Da haben wir doch noch was, um mit der Zunge zu schnalzen!
Folge 34 von Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner bringt zum letzten Mal vor einer zweiwöchigen Pause ganz viel NHL-Glanz. Ex-NHL-Headcoach und GM Tom Rowe analysiert die ersten beiden Wochen in der National Hockey League. Ex-NHL-Referee Tom Cowell plaudert über seinen Bildungsauftrag in der Battle Home Eishockey League. Und Puls24-Expertin Terry Hornig startet die Award Season. Das und noch viel mehr jetzt bei Hockey O'Clock is back with some major NHL content, and it brings me a lot of pleasure to finally announce that every 3 to 4 weeks we're gonna hear it from the horse's mouth himself, so to speak. Someone who's been a general manager in the National Hockey League, someone who's been a head coach in the National Hockey League, and who's well known to Austrian fans as the former head coach of the Black Wings in Linz. None other than Tom Rowe, his second appearance that's solely dedicated to the NHL. And coach, so glad to have you on the show talking about the National Hockey League.
Well, great to be here with you, Martin, and always great to talk with you, obviously.
Coach, the season's been underway now for 2 full weeks. We're recording this conversation on a Friday. It sees the light of day and hits shelves in a couple of days on Tuesday. So a lot can happen in between now and then. So that's just for listeners to consider. But what have been some of the takeaways of the still very young season for you?
I think the critical piece is it's such a short season, 56 games. And teams, and my biggest takeaway, I got three, but the first one would be you can't go into an extended losing streak. You know, if you go 3, 4, 5, 6 games in a row losing or only picking up a few points, you know, right away you're going to put yourself behind the eight. And the league is so good now, and every year it just seems to be getting more talented and faster and skilled scouts. Scouts don't get enough credit for all the dirty work that they do every night going out into rinks that are freezing and, you know, a lot of lonely travel. But they do a great job of finding young talent all over the world. So I think the teams are so good and there's so much parity. You know, if you come out of the gate slow one night and you just don't have it and you lose and that extends into 4, 5, 6 games, you know, you find yourself in a lot of trouble right out of the gate. Because that league, you know, obviously, below the NHL, maybe you can recover, but when you're in the National Hockey League playing against the best and with the best, you know, you just can't afford to dig yourself too big of a hole. So that would be number one. The second part, which I haven't heard a lot of people talking about, but I think it's critical and I think it's going to be vitally important as the season wears on and as teams, you know, get more COVID positive tests or injuries, is the taxi squad. You know, the taxi squad is new this year, obviously, because of what's happened with the pandemic. A team anywhere from 4 to 6 players on that squad. So it does a couple of things. One, it definitely puts pressure on the guys who aren't the stars of the team. So your marginal players, your second, you know, maybe some of your second line guys, but certainly the third, fourth line guys and the fifth, sixth, seventh defenseman, there's no comfort zone there because they know there's a guy in the taxi squad they can bring up at any point, any time. So that puts pressure on those players to stay on top of their game. So there's internal competition right out of the gate, which is readily available, which in a normal year wouldn't be. They'd be down in the American League and they'd have to go through waivers or there'd be all sorts of different scenarios that you'd have to look at if you ever brought somebody up or sent somebody down. Now it's a little easier. Coaches can just plug in a guy from that taxi squad, no problem, and and put somebody who's underperforming up in the press box. The other part of that, it's going to be vitally important for the skilled coaches, the assistant coaches, to keep that taxi squad very sharp, real alert with their skills, keeping them in shape. Because say your team goes on a 7, 8, 9, 10 game winning streak, very seldom is a head coach ever going to want to change that lineup. So a taxi squad is going to need to be properly motivated by the skills coach, by the assistant coaches, making sure they're getting enough work in, and the coaches are keeping it fresh. Because that's a situation where those taxi squad guys, if they're not motivated, it could have a negative effect. And then the last piece of that taxi squad would be, it's going to be critically important for the head coach to be communicating. Now, the head coach is probably never going to go on the ice and work with them. At least most of the time he won't, because he's got so many media obligations. He's got so many other obligations to the guys on the main roster. But it would be important for the head coach to be talking with them and making sure that those players know that they haven't been forgotten about. So I think those, for me, those are the two big ones. And I've watched obviously a lot of games since they started. What surprised me a little bit, just because it was such a long layoff, it was what, 9 months since anybody had really played a game, especially the teams who didn't get into the qualifying round. There were a couple of teams, Detroit in particular. One night I read a quote where one of their players said, well, we just weren't ready. And not being ready mentally and physically for a game, especially now after being out for so long, and like we said in the beginning, having such a shortened schedule, that surprised me, that some teams didn't have the intensity that you might thought they would. So those would be my three things. But the two big ones would be, you know, you can't go into an extended losing streak. And you certainly can't ignore that taxi squad, because I think those are going to be two big things going forward.
I want to touch on the last two topics you mentioned. You as a head coach with the Panthers, how much did you have, or how much contact did you have with guys who were on the roster fringe? Because you mentioned the importance of head coaches getting to know the taxi squad, the players. How did you deal with it when you were head coach?
I went in there. It was a tough situation. We had fired Gerard Gallant. And so the atmosphere, and I'll be just totally honest with you, wasn't real positive. Everybody was pretty upset about what had transpired with him being let go. But that being said, I just went out of my way to try and build relationships with the players. And at that level, and at any level today, it's critically important that you have relationships with the guys and that you're communicating. And I thought we did a pretty good job of that, given the situation it was. And it wasn't fun for anybody. It was not a good situation to be in, but it is what it is. And you got to try and do the best job you can. But guys like Jágr were really good. Jussi Jokinen was really good. Kids that I had in the minors were really good. You know, they knew, guys, especially the guys I had in the minors, they knew exactly what I wanted as a coach and how we needed to play. You know, we had a lot of defensive issues there at the time. But at the end of the day, you do really need to, again, NHL, American Hockey League, no matter where you're coaching, I think you got to hold guys accountable. You got to be fair with them. But you got to be firm all at the same time. And obviously you're never taking a guy like Barkov or Huberdeau or guys like that out of the lineup. You know, you may sit down with them and have a conversation about how they're playing, whether it's good or bad. But at the end of the day, you know, those are your key guys that are going to help you win games. But it's, you know, I'm trying to think, I read an article the other day, Roddy Brind'Amour said, yeah, systems are critical. Strategy is very, very important. But he said, at the end of the day, you better communicate with your players and you better get them to play for you. You don't have a chance. And that's really what it's like. But that's the way it is in every league, not just the National Hockey League. And I think it's better for it. And then I've learned an awful lot over the years. And I'll be honest with you, I probably learned more in Lens last year when I was there, because it's probably the one team that I built relationships with the best. And it definitely had positive outcomes for us, because, you know, we had a nice run going into the playoffs. And to this day, I hear from guys on that team quite a bit, and we've stayed in touch. So that's what it can do. At the end of the day, you got to get the players to play for you. But you can't be phony about it. You got to be sincere in the player, because the players will see right through that too. You know, they want somebody who is going to, one, care about them, and two, make them better as players.
You were mentioning the long period of time that a couple of NHL teams weren't on the ice. Seven teams didn't make the bubble tournament, so to speak. Are those teams, Detroit, for example, the Devils, the Sabres, are those teams going to play catch-up the entire year? How much does it hurt them to not have been on the ice for almost 9 or 10 months?
Yeah, I know. I mean, maybe initially in the beginning, it may have hurt them a little bit. But I don't think it's going to hurt them to get into the playoffs. I mean, they just got to execute, and they've got to start getting some of their players to perform better. I don't think anybody saw what Ottawa's going through right now. I think they're giving up 4, 5, 6, 7 goals against the last 4 or 5 games. So that's not, I really don't think that's a lack of ice time from the long layoff. I just think they're working in so many young kids, and they're rebuilding that whole organization. You're going to have some growing pains, because I think DJ Smith, and I don't know him personally, but I've heard an awful lot of good things about him as a head coach. I think he's got a great future ahead of him, but it's just what you're going through there as far as growing pains go. And that, I'm telling you, the league is just so good. It's amazing how good a league it is. You make one mistake and it's in the back of your net a lot of times. And the same with Detroit. Detroit's, you know, they're incorporating a lot of young kids. They brought in some veteran guys to help with their rebuild. But, you know, with rebuilds comes a lot of growing pains. And that's why when you have patient ownerships and patient GMs, it helps with that building process. But, you know, I just think the teams you mentioned, like Ottawa and Buffalo and Detroit, New Jersey, they're kind of all in the same boat, but I think they've got some quality pieces and they got some quality people there. It'll be only a matter of time, but man, oh man, you got to go through the pain first to get to the level to consistently stay there.
Some of the teams that are on the other side of the spectrum, at the very least, that's what they hope, are Winnipeg and Columbus, pulling off one of the rarely seen early season blockbuster trades last week. Obviously, 6 days ago, again, we're recording this conversation on Friday, January the 29th. Patrick Laine going from Winnipeg to Columbus, along with Jack Roslovic, Pierre-Luc Dubois going to Winnipeg from Columbus, along with a third round pick. And I've done a ton of reading on this trade, and obviously the trade happened right before we did the Columbus-Tampa game on Pulse 24. Depending on whom you're believing, each team kind of won the trade, but if you had to put your finger on one team, who quote-unquote won the trade?
Well, I mean, if you had to pick one team, I mean, I would look at the draft pick. The prospect and obviously the star that Columbus got is the team that won the trade, if you want to call it that. I still think it's too early to tell, but the fact that, you know, they got Roslovic, they got Laine, they got two pieces, and if they can sign Laine to a long-term deal, which I'm sure they're going to try to do, and I'm sure the Finnish background of Laine and Kekalainen is not going to hurt. You know, I guess you could say, yeah, that is a real good piece, because you got two NHL players. Roslovic, you know, obviously nobody's talking about much anyway because of the two huge names that were part of that trade. But he's a real good player with a lot of speed, a lot of skill. What I read yesterday is they're going to put him back in the middle of the ice, which is his natural position, to help fill some of the void of Dubois being traded. But at the end of the day, I think you get two NHL players are going to be able to help you win. And plus, it was just such a toxic environment in Columbus between Tortorella and Dubois. I mean, that wears on everybody. That wears on the player, the coach, the staff, and the players in the locker room. So inevitably it was going to happen. And I think both teams are probably real happy on the players that they got, because Dubois obviously is a high-end talent, a big body who can move up and down the ice and probably has a little better two-way type mentality than, say, Laine was, because Laine is just a pure goal scorer, but a scary guy that can pretty much score at will from anywhere on the ice. So, you know, both teams at the end of the day probably are very happy with the moves that they made. But, you know, you put me on the spot and you have to pick one team, I'd say probably Columbus at this point, probably a little bit ahead in the trade.
Doesn't matter at what league you look in, there's this golden rule that drafts and trades can only be judged like 3 years down the road. So it was kind of mean to put you on the spot and make you pick. But we'll revisit this, I promise, in 3 years' time, and then we'll have another look at it.
Okay. That sounds good.
When talking about trades in general, and granted, during your time as a GM, you probably didn't have to do as many as other GMs who had a longer reign did. But from a very general point of view, what are you looking for as a return in a trade? Would you always go for talent? Would you always go for prospects? Or would you rather go for draft picks? Or does it depend on the situation?
I think it depends on your situation. Now, in Pittsburgh, which is a good example, they always have a team that they feel can win the Stanley Cup. And I think if you're the GM or I'm the GM of that team, you're going to think the same thing with Malkin and Crosby on your roster. And the mentality there is we want to win now. So they're going to give away, you know, they're going to trade away prospects. They're going to trade away draft picks to get players to help get them to the Stanley Cup. So, but if you're a team that's not as close to it as they are, it'd be kind of foolish for you to be taking your young prospects, taking your draft picks and getting rid of them. And I know when I took over in Florida for that short period of time, you know, we were always looking to pick up draft picks. We were always looking to get young prospects because we didn't think we were that close. And we felt we were going to take more of a longer term approach and, you know, build it out over the next 3 to 5 years, probably more along the lines of 3 years. So every time we had a conversation, it was always about, okay, let's take a look at their prospect pool. Let's see how many draft picks they have. Because we felt as an organization, we just needed to get faster, needed to get more skilled. And I thought at the time we needed to definitely be a lot more grittier than we were. And they had a great run with Gerard Gallant there. He did a really good job when he first took over. But we didn't feel like they had, when I took the team over, not just me, but myself, Eric Joyce, when we took it over, we just felt there wasn't enough depth. And what we wanted to do is build the third line, build the fourth line up, where we could literally play a four-line game. Because when we lost out to the Islanders in the first round, it basically came down to lack of depth. And Gerard and I, you know, discussed it. And he wasn't happy a few times when we traded guys like Eric DeBranson away, because Gerard likes to have a big physical element to his teams, which I don't disagree with, and I love that piece of it too. But we just felt at the time we were getting kid by the name of Jared McCann, who they eventually moved over to Pittsburgh. We're getting him and then part of the trade. We're getting a draft pick as part of the trade. And that's kind of what we were looking at. So I think it comes down to what you're looking for, what the situation is, and how you want to build your team.
Now, having those ground rules in place for each and every team, obviously the situation is different. How long does it take to really come up with a trade? Is it sometimes some straight shooting from the hip, or is it hours, days, weeks to go into a trade?
Well, yeah, I mean, some days things come together quickly. Other days it takes a year. You know, sometimes it takes 2, 3, 4 months. I remember talking to Buffalo about Mark Pisick, who is a right-handed defenseman who a lot of people, if you're not tuned into the NHL, may not know, but his analytics were excellent. And we talked to Buffalo. I remember talking to Timmy Murray 4 or 5 days a week for a good 3, 4, 5 months, because that's who we really zeroed in on. We felt he would be a good asset for us, and that's why we went for him, because we just felt the player we were going to give up, one, long-term, wasn't going to be with us, from because we figured his contract demands were going to be too high for us at the time for the return that we would get. So we went for a very serviceable, affordable player in Mark Bissek, who turned out to be a good player for Florida for a little bit. I think he ended up signing in Dallas as a free agent recently. So that would be a small example on how we approached it in Florida and looking at it. And I had a guy by the name of Eric Joyce, who was a real bright guy, very, very strong analytics person. And I leaned heavily on him as far as what the numbers meant. I told him what I thought the kind of player we needed. We looked at a lot of video. We'd get a lot of live scouting reports from our scouts. And then he would crunch numbers on how it would fit into our roster. So that's how we built it. And but the key is just making sure you're getting on the same page with the coach. And then he understands what you're trying to do, which is not always the easiest thing to do, but it's what happens behind the scenes. But yeah, it can happen quickly, but most of the time, especially now in the salary cap age, it takes quite a while to pull off a trade, especially one of any magnitude.
It's a science for itself, trading in the National Hockey League, and I'm sure we're gonna take an even closer look at it sometime down the road. A couple of other topics I wanna touch base on as regards this current very different season in the National Hockey League. We've had Dallas, Carolina, and as of right now, Vegas all having had COVID cases. How confident are you that the National Hockey League regular season will indeed finish as scheduled with a full 56 games played as advertised?
Yeah, I think they'll get the games in. I mean, I think it may stretch out a little bit because of all the games that need to be rescheduled because of the positive tests some of the teams are coming down with. But no, I definitely think they'll finish the 56 game schedule. I think it's probably going to be a wake-up call for some teams. On why are they getting so many cases, and what are they doing behind the scenes? Is everybody wearing masks? Or, you know, they doing all the protocol, following all the protocols that the government has laid out for everybody to follow? And, you know, I think if they're not wearing masks, the second they walk through the door, probably they're going to start, because I think that's probably part of the problem. Guys are probably getting a little lax in that area. And again, you know, you know, blaming anybody, but it's going to be frustrating to walk around a locker room all day long while you're there with a mask on, especially when you're working out and you start sweating and everything else. You know, that those people are going to want to start removing them. And now that this latest strain that's even more contagious or easier to catch, you know, that's another thing that they're going to have to be real careful with. So I'm sure the league offices reached out to all these teams that are starting to have multiple cases and starting to get a little more serious to revisit what they're doing medically to make sure the players are protected. But I do think they'll get all the games in. Yeah.
Now, there have been some discussions if the NHL, which I think left a week long kind of buffer zone to have some makeup games if need be, but even if they, or in case they don't get in the 56 games, some people suggested to just then, in terms of the standings, look at win percentage. Would that be a feasible solution, or is it too early to tell because of the fact that we don't know yet if we are going to get 56 games or not?
Yeah, no, I think the winning percentage would be feasible. I think that's, I'm pretty sure that's what they did last year when the season came to an end. And they had to figure things out. They would definitely go back to that. But I think the overall support would be to try and get all 56 games in and you know, qualify for the playoffs that way instead of doing the play-in round like they did. I'm not so sure everybody was on board with that last year, but it was the best solution for the time. This year, I would think that they're going to try like heck to get all the games in and then qualify for the playoffs the way you normally would.
How much have you enjoyed the realigned divisions this year. Have you enjoyed them, or is something missing for you?
No, I what I liked the most about it with all the Canadian teams in one division. I thought that was pretty cool. I liked that a lot. And being an American and being over here, NBC, I think the first week of the season, NBC was running the Canadian games, which I thought was really neat, because it's, you know, the Canadian market is so passionate about covering their teams. I think you get those built-in rivalries, and then you've got Tkachuk, you know, in Calgary playing the way he plays, and he's already had a few run-ins with some of the teams, Winnipeg and Toronto being one. I think those types of rivalries, I think you're going to see get to a different level as the season goes on. And I think more so in the Canadian division than any other division in the National Hockey League right now. There's just so much pride. And not that there aren't pride in the States that have NHL teams, but when you're in Canada and you're hanging out there for a couple of days, reading all the newspapers and listening to all the shows, I mean, it drives the intensity right up, even with no fans in the building. You know, I just think the Canadian division for me is the most fun to watch right now.
But, and this depends on whom you trust, who you believe, who you read. I've heard takes that it long term, and who knows however long this is going on, but that even short term it might hurt the game a little, because Canadians and hockey fans in Canada just focus on their division, whereas U.S. American hockey fans just focus on their three respective divisions. Do you think it helps the game to have an all Canada division, or is there some kind of split, some kind of separation happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I don't think it hurts the game. I really don't. Media coverage, you know, that's one thing, and the Canadian markets do it better than anybody, I think. But at the end of the day, the game comes down to the players playing, and it's so fast and it's so skilled. And there are so many young guys doing things with the puck and making plays that I think at the end of the day, if you're a non-hockey fan and you just, you know, turn on a game and you see some of the things that these guys can do, you're going to fall in love with it that way. I live in South Carolina, play golf with a lot of guys who are not hockey fans. And they catch it now, and that's all they talk about. They just said, my God, they said, I can't believe what these guys can do with the puck at the speed that they can do it. Now, once they go to a game live in the building, you know, they're hooked forever. So I just think the game is getting so much better every single year, and faster and skilled. It's so much fun for fans to watch.
And it's something that fans in Austria now get on free-to-air television as well, which is why I put out a poll to a couple of fans and asked them which teams we should break down on this podcast. And I mentioned it earlier, every 3 to 4 weeks, you're going to bring your NHL expertise on Hockey O'Clock. And during each and every airing of this podcast, we're going to break down two teams. The two teams that people wanted us to, or wanted you to have a closer look at this time around, are the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Montreal, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Ooh, that big mistake almost. two very popular teams in Europe, two very successful teams, which kind of speaks for their popularity in Europe. I want to start with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Very interesting case study, highly successful, always competitive, have won three cups with Crosby and Malkin. How long do you think those two will be able to carry the team?
Great question. I think Crosby, and I'll talk about each guy separately, but Crosby probably another 4 years, 5 years, I think he's going to be productive. And the reason being, he's incredibly detailed on his nutrition, on his conditioning. He really looks after himself, away from the rink, plays the game the right way. And he's the one who really sets the tone for guys who get traded there. I've talked with a few guys who've been traded there, and they say right away, he's the first guy that comes over to welcome you. They really like him. He's a real good guy. So he creates the standard, obviously, because he's the best player in the world. He creates a standard for how they're going to compete every single night. So as long as you've got him there, I believe you're going to always have a chance to win. And I do believe he's probably got another good, solid 4 or 5 years ahead of him. And then as far as Malkin goes, Malkin's an unbelievable talent. There's no denying that. It's just, and there's an article now about, I think today, saying he vows to help the team win. With Malkin, it's just, you're just not sure what you're going to get every night. And even though he's in a slow start, he's probably going to come out of it and he's going to get hot again and they'll start producing. But you're just not sure. And I'm not sure if I'm the head coach there, you want to, you know, bet the house on him every single night because he's just too inconsistent. Dynamic offensively, no doubt about that. But defensively, he really struggles. Not so sure he likes to pay a lot of attention to that side of the puck. That being said, he probably still has another 2-3 real good years ahead of him. But I think he just needs to try and limit the inconsistencies of his play. And, you know, some nights he's there, you can't stop him. But then there are other nights that, you know, you're not too sure he's even dressed in the lineup. So I think those two on the same roster, you're always going to have a chance to win. But then now that they've had a major, major change with Jimmy Rutherford, and now they're going to be in the search for a new general manager, it'll be interesting to see what type of GM that they bring in there to help Bill continue to be a winner, but also build for the future.
Going to talk about the GM situation in a bit. Something interesting that Evgeny Malkin said after the latest loss against the Boston Bruins regarding his cold streak. It's 7 games played, 1 goal, and only 13 shots on goal. He said, "It's tough to say any good things about my game right now, but I hope it's coming and I believe in myself." So obviously he's honest, but as a head coach, when one of your top players struggled, how did you try to build him up to get his game going?
You kind of leave him alone for the first couple of games, but man, after it starts going into game 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and that player is one of the key guys that you're banking on, you really do need to nip it in the bud quickly and sit down with them and try to, and I'm not saying sit down with them and get into an argument with them, but just sit down with them and help sort through some things with them as far as, you know, one, where's your head at? You know, what are you thinking? What are you struggling with? You know, let's have a conversation about it. But even before the meeting even starts, and just about every coach would be doing this, pull some video up, you know, get some good positive clips of that player doing a lot of good things, you know, show him some clips of him dominating games, which is what Malkin can do at times, and a lot of times. So I think that would be the approach. If you think you're going to be able to get in his face and get into a, you know, match with him going back and forth, that's just never going to work. And it certainly doesn't work anymore. I don't care who you're talking to. But that would be my approach. And obviously I know a lot of coaches and it would be very similar to their approach on how they would try and get a guy like Malkin out of it. At the end of the day, the great teams, and then this is where Pittsburgh's so good, is they have high, high work ethic. You know, they compete every night. You know, they've gone through some lulls recently. But they are a hard charging group of guys. They've got a lot of pride. They're skilled guys. They've got a lot of compete in them and they show up and they make life absolutely miserable for the opponent. I mean, when they're going, they are no fun to play against. And, you know, and it's tough for them too, because everybody gets up for the Pittsburgh Penguins, like everybody, you know? So, you know, every single game, you know, guys are running for you because you got Crosby, you got Malkin, you got Letang, you know, you got some of the best players in the world on your roster. So if you're not ready to go every single night, then you're going to have some off nights. And right now, yeah, they're having a little bit of a tough stretch. Boston tuned them up pretty good last night, 4-1. And that's where Mike Sullivan, I'm sure, is, you know, getting a little frustrated, where he needs to have Malkin show up and start producing and competing. But at the end of the day, when you have a skilled team and they've got a high level of work ethic, that's a nasty, nasty combination to try to coach against and play against.
Heading into the season, most experts said the goalkeeper situation in Pittsburgh is something to keep an eye on. Barely came to pass. Not a lot of good things that have happened between the pipes in Pittsburgh. What's your assessment on the Tristan Jarry and Jacob DeSmith situation?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know them well enough, but here's what I would say about them. If, you know, they were picked over Murray and they moved Murray to Ottawa, I would say that both of these kids, they're young goaltenders, and, you know, they're going to have their growing pains, especially in that position. That is such a tough, tough position to step into the National Hockey League and expect to be winning right out of the gate. And then that's where you've got to have guys on the same page in front of them. At the end of the day, you know, yeah, the goalie gets a lot of blame, and I think goalies get too much blame sometimes. It's about the, you know, six guys on the ice and the five guys in front of the goaltender. You know, you've got to be playing good defense. The goalie needs to know where those shots are coming from. And if the goalie doesn't know where the shots are coming from, then he's going to start guessing. He's going to start moving a little bit too early. He's going to maybe start pulling away short side, and they score on him there. If the team in front of them is consistent and real structured, which Pittsburgh is, I mean, Mike Sullivan's a phenomenal coach. He's won two Stanley Cups back-to-back, which is incredibly difficult to do. They just, again, kind of like what we talked about Ottawa earlier and New Jersey, Detroit, Buffalo, they're going through some growing pains because they're bringing in some new pieces. But at the end of the day, I think once the season is starting to wind down, Pittsburgh will definitely be there. But I just think both goalies have got a lot of talent, and I think they're going to be just fine. But again, that goaltending position is, oh my God, it's such a tough position for a young kid to step into. Give them time. Quality coaches, quality players in Pittsburgh, and they'll be there in the end.
Have to correct myself. I said Jacob DeSmith. It's of course Casey DeSmith. Yeah. Just in case to get this one straight. But obviously the goaltender situation, as every other position on the roster, is something to look at for the new incoming general manager. You know, in Jim Rutherford fairly well. He resigned citing personal reasons. Now a Swede named Patrick Alvin, assistant GM, is taking over on an interim basis. Just to let people know, how closely are you as a GM working together with your assistant GM, and how easy would such a transition, or how difficult would such a transition be?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy transition going from assistant GM to the GM, literally in a day's time, is never easy. But the GM and assistant GM would work very, very close together. I don't know many assistant GMs who aren't in on every single conversation that's going on with the GM that he's having with other teams in the National Hockey League. So they're joined at the hip. And I know Jimmy had an awful lot of trust, confidence in Patrick from what I had been told and what I read. So that would be a seamless transition as far as attitude and philosophy. So, you know, Patrick would be in charge of all the scouting because that's what his background was or is. So none of that would really change. It would really come down to contracts, salary cap, things like that, which I'm assuming they have people behind the scenes that are handling the cap. At the end of the day, GM needs to know who can play and who can't. You can hire somebody to do your cap, to negotiate the contracts, to negotiate contracts. But if you better know as the GM, you better know who can play and who can play. And when trades come up for discussion, if the agency comes up for discussion, you need to know who those guys are. They're going to make you a better team. You go out and find a lawyer, you go out and get a capologist to do, you can be average and all that, because you can hire people to do those jobs, which is what most GMs have done. You know, there's a specialist for your cap. You know, you got contract negotiators. So it's become so specialized a job. And there's so much to do. And the CBA is so darn complicated, along with the salary cap. You better have a GM in place that knows the talent and who it is that can play. Because I think, you know, that to me is probably the biggest part of the job.
Now, as a successor for Jim Rutherford, well, fans have still wait for him. What kind of GM do you think would be a good fit for Pittsburgh? Is there even a chance that Alvin goes all the way and stays or remains GM?
Yeah, I do think there's a chance that Alvin could stay there. Because what they have to do is they have to rebuild their player pool, the prospect pool. You know, they don't have as many as they had at one point. Because of what we talked about earlier, they've traded a lot of draft picks and younger prospects to win the Stanley Cups, which is what you should do. You know, when you're close, like they were all the time and are, you know, that's what you have to do that. And that's what your fans expect. That's what ownership expects. And most important thing is what the players expect. So they can't be criticized for not having a huge prospect pool, because anybody in the National Hockey League would have done exactly like what Jimmy did, is trade the draft picks away to get those players to put you over the top. But I would think going forward, and some of the names you're being that you hear about, a guy like Ronnie Hextall, who I don't believe gets a ton of credit for what he did in Philadelphia. And that team in Philadelphia is winning a lot of games now, and a lot of those guys are the ones that he drafted and developed. So I would think he's going to be given serious consideration. I know they're talking about Jason Botterill, and Jason isn't the evaluator of talent that Hextall is, but he's a brilliant communicator, incredibly bright guy, very organized guy, and knows the cap inside and out. So he that's where his strength lies. But he has good talent evaluators already in Pittsburgh. So that'd be another name that's being very, very seriously discussed there. And I know he's very well thought of in Pittsburgh. Regardless of what happened in Buffalo, it didn't work out. Doesn't mean it was his fault. It just didn't go in a direction, obviously, that they wanted or he wanted. But believe me, he's a very bright, bright young guy, and he'll be given serious consideration. And then, you know, you get the other guys, you know, the Chris Drurys of the world being mentioned. Not so sure he's ready to be a GM, especially for that organization. So I would think you're going to find a guy that, if I was picking it, if I was the owner, I'd probably want to have a guy who's really good at evaluating talent. Another huge name is Mark Hunter, who was in Toronto when they were drafting Mitch Marner and all those guys that are in Toronto right now. So I think what Pittsburgh needs going forward is they need a real good guy at the top that can evaluate talent.
Interestingly enough, the name Tom Rowe hasn't come up yet with the Pittsburgh Penguins GM search.
Yeah, and I don't think it will either.
But let's just assume for the sake of the argument, you were in charge, even if it were on an interim basis. It is a stacked roster at some positions, but then again, each and every team is looking for improvements throughout the year. Pittsburgh in the Mass Mutual East Division, and granted, not a lot of games have been played yet, is right on that fringe, right around that fourth place that secures a playoff spot. What would you, as a GM, do to try to make the roster better? Where do you identify, quote unquote, deficiencies?
I would probably on the back end with their defense. I think, first of all, you got to sit down with your head coach and talk to him and get his input, right? And I'm sure Patrick has done that already. But I would think they could probably use a stay-at-home defensive-minded defenseman. That would be one area. And then, they have enough talent on their top two lines. You know, maybe take a look at the third or fourth line. If there's another guy in the market that you can pick up that can play a good, solid two-way game, not necessarily go out and score a ton of points, but obviously that's always a huge plus. You can find them, but just bring a little bit of defensive mindset to the game. I think that's probably what they're potentially could be looking for. And that's not going to break the bank to try and do that. And, you know, and I'm sure Patrick's already been on the phone talking to all the teams, and I'm sure he's getting an awful lot of calls from GMs who, you know, want to see what he's going to be doing as far as trying to improve the roster.
Going to move our attention to the Scotia North Division. Obviously, a very pleasant surprise so far. Not that it's a surprise, but a very pleasant season for Leafs fans. 9 games played so far, 7 wins. How would you assess that first 9 games of Toronto?
Yeah, I mean, I love watching Toronto. It's probably out of the NHL now, it's probably my favorite team to watch, just because they have so much skill, they have so much speed. I think they did a great job in the offseason going out and picking up a guy like Simmons to give them a little bit of grit, a guy like Bogosian, because I think that's the piece that they were probably missing a little bit. When you get guys like Matthews and Nylander and Marner, Tavares, Riley, Dermott, I mean, my God, that's an awfully fun team to watch. And they can skill you to death because they got so many skilled guys. I think they're probably, you know, that it's a big reason why they brought Joe Thornton in and Spezza in is to help teach them how to play a more consistent game. And again, I think they're right on the cusp now, and I think this will be a huge year for them. I'm sure if they don't go on a deep, deep run in the playoffs, the media specifically and the fans are not going to be happy. But again, they're still putting that whole piece together there. But they've got the most difficult piece already put in place with all the skill they've got. Now, finding the pieces for the third and fourth line and your fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth defenseman, you know, shoring that piece of it up is probably what they're really, really working on. And read a great article in the summertime that Kyle Dubas was quoted in. And basically what he was saying was, you know, if there's a 50-50 puck, how determined are you going to be to go get that 50-50 puck? You know, how willing are you going to want to go to the hard scoring areas to score a goal, knowing that you're probably going to get pounded by some guy, you know, doing it in the meantime. So that's where it's coming down to. The Detroit Red Wings, when Kenny Holland was GM and Steve Yzerman was the captain, I mean, that team, you know, they had Probert at the time and they had Joe Koser, but over time, those guys moved on and retired. And they didn't have that element, but every single guy in that Detroit team were so mentally tough. They could care less about going into Boston, knowing it was going to be a physical game, knowing that they were going to probably get run out a little bit. They didn't care. They just played their game, you know, and they didn't get intimidated one iota. But they had a ton of guys who had skill. They had 4 lines and 6-7 defensemen who could play. And that's how they beat you. You know, they said, yeah, if you want to try and beat us up, go for it. But at the end of the day, we're going to win the hockey game. And they were very, very, probably one of the most mentally tough teams in the modern era. And that's where I think Dubas and Keefe, coach in Toronto, is probably where they're trying to get the Maple Leafs to, is you beat your asses off. And for me, toughness isn't dropping the gloves and fighting. Toughness is, you know, going into the corner, going to the net, taking a hit, making a hit to make a play. That's the toughness that you're looking for in today's skilled players.
Now, the guy who many people thought would take Toronto back to the promised land was Mike Babcock. Obviously, those two parties now go their separate ways. There's been some bad blood. There's been a lot of articles written about the situation. What's your take on what has unraveled in Toronto during and after the Mike Babcock era?
I think one, he's a great coach. I mean, you can't take anything away from him as far as that goes. Probably one of, if not the most detailed guy, doesn't leave any stone unturned as far as preparation goes. I think where he ran into trouble, he was just too hard charging, wanted control of the entire situation when it came to the locker room. And I'm sure, you know, now that he's had time to sit back and evaluate and see what happened, and he'd probably, would he admit it? I don't know, because I don't know him at all. But I think going forward, because he is going to want to coach again, he's got it in his blood. He's got too much passion for it. I'm sure he's going to sit back and reevaluate how he handled certain things, and maybe won't publicly admit it, but probably would admit it to himself that, yeah, I'm going to have to change my ways of working with the players. It kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier. The players are too educated today. They want to know why you're doing things and why are we doing it this way. And if you're not willing to do that, if you're not willing to give them explanations, and if you're not willing to give them a little bit of freedom, and I just don't think it's going to work. You know, when I first started coaching, I was in guys' faces a lot at the minor league level. I held them accountable. But I also think if somebody came to me with an idea and I thought, or we as coaches thought it would help us, you know, we would do it. The players want to have a voice. And if you don't want to give them a voice, man, oh, man, it is going to be difficult. And like I said, I wouldn't say you're going to do every single thing that they want, but you certainly need to listen. And that's where I think the situation in Toronto got probably a little sketchy, because it just wasn't enough give and take. I guess that's the best way to explain it, because when he went there, I just said, wow. I said, with the GM in place at the time, Kyle Dubas was there, and then they brought Lou Lamoriello in. Lou Lamoriello did a phenomenal job. Obviously, he's got a track record to back it up. But behind the scenes, everybody knew at some point in time Kyle Dubas was going to take over. And whether Kyle being as young as he was at the time and still is, and Mike obviously being the experienced veteran, is that where it got off kilter? I have no idea. I will tell you, but Mike's a great coach, unbelievably detailed, but I think probably for that situation, a little too aggressive on how things wanted or should have been handled. And it just didn't mesh, obviously, with the way the front office was thinking at the time. But he got him back to the playoffs. I think he set a standard there and expectations. And now they just continue to build on that in a different way.
Now, there's a 22-year age difference between Dubas and Babcock. Kyle Dubas still only being 35 years of age and already a veteran of being a general manager in his third year of doing it full time. Is he at the forefront of this new wave of young GMs that are incoming?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think a lot of older general managers have taken notice and probably have changed on how they do things. Kyle Dubas is again, I don't know him. I just read an awful lot about him and watched his interview. He's a real bright guy, very bright guy. Really looks after the players, has set up a great atmosphere in Toronto. And, you know, he knows how to treat the players, knows how to treat their families. Very, very organized, very detailed guy. Big into analytics, which you have to be today. And anybody who says analytics is a waste of time is basically full of BS, because the analytics is a critical piece. It's not the whole piece, but it's definitely part of it. And he's got some real sharp people on his staff. But yeah, you want to limit your mistakes. You're always going to make mistakes, but you want to limit those mistakes. If you can have a piece that are numbers driven, and you take your live scouting and then you take video scouting and you put the three of them together, you're going to limit the mistakes that you make. And I would say he's done a real good job of that there. All you got to do is take a look at the roster. Now, there are a lot of scouts who are paranoid about it because they think it's going to take their job. But the intent is not to take scouts' jobs. It's just that you have a tool that you can use and maybe better educate the scouts, you know. But also, the scouts can better educate the analytics people too. So the biggest challenge is just getting everybody to work together. And I know when I took over Florida, we made a lot of scouting changes, but it wasn't that we were trying to get rid of scouts. It was just atmosphere and things that were going on behind the scenes was the biggest reason we changed the number of people that we changed. And but at the end of the day, you need to have a combination of the analytics, the live scouts, and the video. And then you pick your roster. And that's what Kyle, I think, does a great job of and works hard at it. And he's brought in, I mean, they've got an ungodly budget there in Toronto. They can do a lot of things that a lot of teams can't. So he's got resources around him that are going to eventually win him a Stanley Cup, I believe. I mean, they got a lot of good players there.
As always, everything starts in the net. And as we take a closer look at the roster, the one question that a lot of Maple Leafs fans have been asking themselves is Frederik Andersen a Stanley Cup winning caliber goaltender in your estimate?
Yeah. I'm going to say yes, because when I was in Florida, we were seriously thinking about going after him, because we knew Roberto Luongo was, you know, on the back end of his career, and we needed to find a goaltender to come in. Yes, I do. Again, I think the problems in Toronto, and they're still going through those, is on the defensive side of the puck. And again, as long as the goalie knows where that puck and shot are coming from, most of the time he's going to have a good chance of stopping it, or at least you give him a chance to stop it. So I've watched a lot of games in Toronto, especially last year, where he was just getting bombarded with shots and grade A scoring chances against. And that's just a recipe for disaster, because at some point your goaltender is going to wear down mentally and physically, but probably more mentally. It's going to have its toll than physically. And that's where I think that's why they went out and got Muzzin. They probably brought in Simmons to help with the defensive side of the puck, play a more organized two-way game. That's why I love Mitch Marner so much, and a lot of people love him so much, because he can light it up on the scoreboard, but he's probably one of the best defensive players they got on the team. I mean, he's a brilliant kid on both sides of the puck, and that's where that team will really become even tougher to play against than they are now, once they become a consistent defensive team when they don't have the puck. It always makes me laugh when coaches get tagged as always an offensive coach or as a defensive coach. You got to play both sides. And as a coach, you got to be able to teach both sides. And that's where your assistant coaches are vital, is being able to get your message to the players and develop good habits, you know, develop solid systems, but systems that aren't so complicated that it confuses the players. You got to keep it simple. But it's got to be structured, and that's where I think Toronto is eventually going to get to.
Now, if you look at the roster, and especially at the contracts of the Maple Leafs, there are three players with a cap hit of more than $10 million a year: with Marner, with Matthews, with Tavares. A very top heavy roster in salary cap terms. How many nights do you think their salary cap analysts are losing in terms of sleep when looking at how the roster is constructed?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough job there, because I was looking at it this morning. They got $40 million wrapped up in seven players, you know, $40 million plus, somewhere around there. And the salary cap has changed, especially this year, because of what's going on. But they got $41 million approximately, you know, give or take, wrapped up in seven players, right? So that leaves the rest of your roster. You know, you got to figure out what you're going to do with your third and fourth line guys and your fifth to seventh defenseman and your backup goaltender. Because then you got $11.6 million with Matthews. You got $11 million with Tavares. You got $10.9 million with Marner. And it drops down to Nylander at 6.9. And then, but then you got Muzzin at 5.6, Riley at $5 million, and then Andersen at $5 million. So that's a lot of money propped up in seven guys, right? But that's where your capologists are critical to figure out. You know, I know they probably have some guys on long-term injury where that money comes off the salary cap. So this, and it's, and I'm not smart enough to sit here and give you all the details of it. But that's where it gets really complicated, is how you're going to maneuver your roster. That's why Dubas went out and got Spezza. That's why he brought in Joe Thornton, guys that he knew had serviceable years left in their careers, but weren't going to cost them a boatload of money. And now I know people have criticized him for how he's put that roster together. But, man, are you going to let Matthews or Marner or Nylander, are you going to risk losing them when they have time to be an unrestricted free agent? And, you know, because you don't want to pay them the money now. Then you get the guy like Tavares that, you know, demand $11 million. And, you know, you can't pass up on those guys. And that's where your development, and that's why he spends, or Toronto spends, so much money on player development, because they know that they got to have guys that can play on the third, fourth line spot and those fifth, sixth, seventh defenseman spots that aren't going to cost them a boatload of money. So I don't know. I've heard people criticize him for doing it the way he's done it, spending so much money on his elite level skill, but he's got elite level skill that a lot of teams don't have. And I don't know, it's pretty tough to just let that, you know, let some of that walk away. And they did risk possibly losing Marner if they didn't do something to the level that they did it at. And man, I don't know. It's a tough, tough situation. And that's where your American Hockey League coach is critical. Your development people are critical. And sports psychologist is critical, because you really need to make sure you're developing and you've got your pipeline filled of players, younger players that you can bring up that aren't going to cost a lot of money. So people a lot smarter than me are going to have a lot of fun trying to figure out how they do those contracts in Toronto going forward.
And that what gives us some more fuel for added discussions. One last question regarding the Toronto Maple Leafs, and granted, I received this question, and at times we kind of for sure dipped in on a couple of reasons why that may be. But the question goes like this: why is Toronto not been able to be a consistent contender? Granted, it's awfully difficult to be a consistent contender, but what, in your estimation, is missing for being a consistent contender?
I just think they went, in the beginning, they went too much skill. They had a lot of the same type of guys. They had guys who all wanted the puck, didn't really necessarily worry about the defensive side, regardless of what, you know, they may have been saying at the time. I think that's part of it. I don't think they had enough grit. I don't think they had enough size. They had too many of the same type of guys. And defensively, they just weren't a good team. They hadn't learned or had not learned that side of the puck yet. They're definitely better now. And I think starting this year, it doesn't mean they're going to win the Stanley Cup this year, even though that's what the goal is. But now you can really judge that team starting this year, and I think over the next 3 years. Okay, so they're probably going to be, or they're definitely going to be in the mix of a contender, a team being talked about as a Stanley Cup contender because of the skill level that they have. It'll be how their coaching staff can get across their message to play a defense. You have to play defense. I don't care how good you are, and I don't care, you know, how much talent you have. You have got to keep the puck out of your net, and you can't be giving up grade A chances every single night at the tune of 14-15. Grade A chances, because you're just not going to win that way, especially in the playoffs. So I just think it's a maturity level thing, and that's it. And once they get tired of listening to their media saying, you know, they can't win the big one and they can't get out of the first round and they can't do this and they can't do that, which they're probably there already. You know, now they've got some, you know, good experience with Simmons and Thornton and Spezza and Muzzin, guys who have been there and know what it takes to win. And then you got Zach Hyman, who you don't hear a lot about. Great player, really good two-way, hard-nosed, strong on the puck type of a player. So their pieces are definitely better now since they brought some of that veteran leadership in. And I think now this is the year you can really watch them take off. I do think they will, because the defensive piece, the mental toughness piece, now they've been through it a few times. They've had some disappointments. But now I think you'll see them really take off and do what they're supposed to do.
Three more questions to round this out as we hit the hour mark of our conversation already. And it does feel like 10 minutes and not an hour. Pittsburgh Penguins, playoff bound or not?
Yes.
Toronto Maple Leafs, round three, or are they going to advance even further?
No, I think they'll, I don't know if they'll get to the finals, but I do think they'll get to the conference finals. Yep.
Which would be round three. And granted, this is very early in the season and all the projections. It's very mean of me to ask you like this, because I know I'm so bad at picks and projections myself. So I know how awful this job really is, and I'm sure a lot of listeners at home hopefully appreciate the tough job that you've been dealt. Last question, as we were talking about the Leafs, as we were talking about the Penguins, and you especially mentioned how much joy the Leafs bring to you, what hockey team, granted that in Europe, East Coast teams are bigger draws just because of the time difference, but what team that not a lot of people, hockey fans, have on their radar should they really watch, and why?
In the National Hockey League?
Right.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, my old team is Florida. I obviously watch that team very close because I want to see what they're doing and how well they're doing it. And the reason they're a different team this year, and they lost last night in a shootout, but they're off to their best start in franchise history. But they've finally got the mix of talent, but more importantly, they got grit now. They got guys who, you know, are going to pay the price. They're going to go to the net. And I think the fact that Bill Zito brought in Patrick Hornquist was huge, because that guy just will not be denied. So that, I do think Florida is going to be an interesting team to watch. And I'm not so sure I would have said that before Bill Zito was brought in and made the changes that he made. It's a fun team to watch. So if I'm a European hockey fan and, you know, want to see an up and coming team, you got Barkov, Verhaeghe, and, you know, you got speed there like you wouldn't believe. And you got skill in Barkov that's unbelievable. He can stick handle in a phone booth, like the old saying goes. That would be a team to watch, because they compete. They got a great head coach, and he's definitely a guy who has won Stanley Cup, so he knows how to win behind the bench. So that'll be a team to really keep a close eye on.
Nobody better to recommend this, coach. Thank you so much for taking such extensive time. We're going to do this in 3-4 weeks down the road again, but for the time being, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Great being with you.
Unsere Liga, dein Spiel. Der neue Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League, Bet at Home, hat ein tolles Angebot für alle echten Hockey-Fans. Spiel mit und hol dir jetzt einen Ice Hockey League Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Zusätzlich verlost Bet at Home einmal zwei Tickets für ein Ice Hockey League Spiel deiner Wahl am nächsten Spieltag. Geh einfach auf die Bet at Home Facebook-Seite und schick uns eine Nachricht mit deiner Lieblingsmannschaft. Bet at Home. Das Leben ist ein Spiel. Rechtlicher Hinweis: Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter spielerschutz.eu.
Hockey Clock is back with some refereeing, and it's not only some refereeing, it is the refereeing. If you look at the person who's sitting in front of me, he's Tom Cowell. He's a referee of more than 1,000 games officiated in the best hockey league in the world. He's now on the Hockey Clock. And Tom, first of all, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited. I certainly hear good things about your program from Lyle and the people here. So yeah, very excited. Thanks for having me.
Tom, what brings you as a former National Hockey League referee to Austria?
Well, certainly for me, it's a connection with Lyle Seitz and Grant Kimmerly. Certainly I worked in the ice with both of them, considering both good friends. And Certainly with COVID and different things trying to get over here, the feeling was that they needed some help in the buildings, because it probably hasn't been as much as there normally would be with COVID. So certainly I'd been sitting at home for a while, and the opportunity to come over and spend some time, not only in the rinks, but just talking hockey with, you know, the people that run the league and the coaches, general managers, sports managers. Certainly a tremendous opportunity for me.
You've been developing refereeing talent for quite some time. What's your exact assignment in Austria as regards the Benetton Ice Hockey League?
Well, basically, you know, you look at me like a coach, like a team, a coach of a hockey team. So every hockey team has a coach. The officials need a coach. So Greg Kimmerly's done quite a bit of that. So that's my role. I'll go to the rinks and coach the officials before and after the game. And then sometimes, like I'm in the office today, I'll watch games of guys I haven't seen yet and try and have an understanding of them before I see them. So basically, it's no different than the coach of the team. My team of coaches, the officials.
Where's your focus going? You're taking on a new league. You got referees that you try to educate and try to help. And then you got new players, new coaches. What's the list of things that you try to work on look like? What's the first thing you're going to tackle?
Well, I think for me, like, it's been 2 weeks now. So to get, and I'd seen quite a few games on TV before I came over. So like a handle where we're at in terms of our sight lines and look in the right areas. And once we start doing those things, then certainly our judgment. And then once we get, you know, kind of through that process and my understanding of the guys in the league, then we can start to talk about game management and philosophies on plays. And certainly I'm a huge proponent of communication with the players and coaches. So certainly that's another element to improve on and continue to work on is our communication. So those are kind of things that I think are really important.
Thing is, we're gonna break them down little by little. But the couple of days, weeks you've been in Austria, how has getting settled been for you? How's traveling been? I reckon airports nowadays gonna be more like ghost towns than airports as we know them.
Yeah, getting over here was a little bit more of a challenge, but once we got here, it was fine. I'm staying with Lyle Seitz, and he says it never snows here, but every day I seem to be snowed in. But so the travel's been, you know, it's been okay. Just kind of getting used to it. Been down in Klagenfurt and certainly Salzburg and some other places. So getting around now seems pretty comfortable. So I'm excited now as we move along to expand a little bit, and, you know, coming to Vienna this weekend and start to get more centers. And I think that's important because it's going to expand the number of teams and number of officials you see.
Now, as Pulse 24 is also the official NHL broadcaster in Austria, we try to get people used to the smaller surface, the smaller rink, the smaller ice the past couple of weeks. But from a refereeing standpoint, you coming from the smaller sheet to the European size sheet. Is there any difference in terms of refereeing? And if so, what would that be?
There is. And it's been a bit of a challenge for me to kind of talk to the guys and ask them, you know, why they're in certain places on the ice. Certainly, you know, with the ice being so wide here, there are times where for me, the first week or so, the guys were way out when the play was across the ice, whether it be the low guy or the high guy. And linesmen too sometimes. So, you know, there's some dialogue for me to say, okay, well, why are we where we are? And now understanding that sight line created on the bigger ice is completely different. So, you know, where I'm used to them being from the dot to the boards, they might have to be a little farther at times, right? Especially if the play is in the far corner. So certainly some great conversations with our officials to understand why they're where they are. And then sometimes to say, okay, well, in my opinion, even with that thought process, this might be a better place. So certainly it is a little bit of a learning curve for me to understand where we're going with things.
How often have you been on a bigger sheet yourself to just get a feel for sight lines, to just get a feel for what guys might be looking at?
And not a lot, to be honest with you. Certainly my amateur career, I worked World Championship in Geneva. So that was a couple of rings over the years that we played on the big ice exhibition games or different things before I worked for the National League. So I don't have a ton of experience on the big ice.
Gonna talk a little bit about you, letting people know who's the one NHL referee that tries to help our referee program taking the next step or one of the next steps. How did you stumble or get into refereeing?
Stumble is a good word. I think, I was young and my dad was the president of minor hockey. And I think for him, I was 13 or 14, going and becoming a referee, there's some life skills there. I mean, it's a challenge. You got to make decisions in a hurry. You got to deal with sometimes irrational people. You got to learn how to communicate. And I think one of the things my dad thought is it builds kind of within the game and away from the game too, and how you live your life. And I think that's, my dad kind of pushed me into it. And that's, I look back now and I think that's why he understood there were some life lessons that I could learn. And I was lucky enough that I liked it and stumbled into being good at it. And it, obviously for me, it's become a career that I'm very lucky that I had.
I mean, obviously, there are a couple of great qualities that make or break a good ref, I'd say. But what's the one key component that every aspiring referee needs to bring to the table?
Well, I think obviously there's a lot of components. The physical side of it, the judgment, all that stuff. But I'm a firm believer that personality plays a huge part in officiating, and I'm a firm believer that communication is the key component. We have to get the teams and the coaches and the players to respect us, to understand us. We know they're not always going to agree with us, but through our communication skills and getting to know them a little bit on the ice and whenever we get the chance, if we can create respect or rapport within the game, we're going to get through those hard situations. Because even though they might be mad at that call or mad at that certain play, we've created a communication and respect.
Let's look back on your long and successful career, and let's tackle the first thing that you mentioned, the physical aspect. How has physicality, how has trying to be in shape evolved over your career? What has changed?
When I started, we'd just go to a camp and we'd ride a bike and, we were in shape, we thought, but boy, in the past, the last 10 years of my on ice career, just because the game became so fast, huge component for us now. Certainly skating is a huge thing, but you don't have to be the greatest skater in the league. You just got to skate at a certain level, but being in shape is, a great example is years ago, the players would go to camp for 3, 4, 5 weeks. I mean, now in the NHL in 3 days, they're playing exhibition games because everybody is expected to be in shape. So certainly if on ice guy now, it's a year round program just to stay in shape. And you know what? I mean, I retired at 50, some guys get to 52 or 48. You're chasing around 20-year-old kids nowadays, so it's a huge component.
Let's just stick with the part of getting in shape. If people out there think, okay, it's might not be good enough for playing the sport as a pro, but who are considering getting into a refereeing career, what's the bare minimum of being in shape, and how can you try to get in shape for being a referee?
Well, I like to tell the guys when I talk to them, what the expectation is whatever level you're working at, whatever conditioning those guys are in, whatever kind of shape they're in, that's what's expected of you. And everybody, and I think as you age is different, right? Some guys are runners naturally. Certainly biking's good, right? Whatever you could fall into, right? I am a proponent of not running. I think as time goes on, it's hard on your knees for the older guys and things like that, but whatever you're comfortable with, but the expectation would be the same as whatever league you're working, same as the players.
Is it all about endurance or are the things factoring in?
Yeah, I think other things factor in. Certainly, the game's not like it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago where you needed the great big linesman with the big shoulders to break up the fights. But I think it's a full component, right? Certainly the endurance, being able to stand. Because let's remember, if we're not coming off the ice for breaks, so we're on the ice for 60 minutes. And if we get tired, our minds don't work as well as they could. And then what happens is, our legs don't work. And, you can't miss the shift as an official. So if you miss one shift and that's the time that you don't take that extra stride to get a sight line and you miss the hook, the high stick, the headshot, whatever it is. I mean, that's the only thing that everybody remembers is that one shift you missed. So it's really important that we stay with that.
Has there ever been a time, and doesn't have to be in your career, have you ever witnessed or been part of a game where one official just was wasted because obviously the game went back and forth and you had to skate so much that you were completely out of it at game's end?
Oh, for sure. I more so in the minors, right? When it's part-time guys trying to make it, right? But I think once you get to the National League level, I mean, everybody's a professional and understands it. And certainly at that level, I mean, everybody's, you know what, you work so hard, you are tired when it's over, but you're certainly at a level that you can get through it.
In what regard, I mean, as a player, there's an aging process. And obviously at 38, you shouldn't be able to do things that you were able to do at 25. How do you age as a referee?
Well, I think it's the same, obviously. I think we're a little bit older and everybody's different. Some guys start to age at 45 and some, you know, make it to 52 or 3. But, you know, I think it's the same as that wily old player, like that player that now is 37 or 38, that's a step slower. But what he is, he has 25 or 15 years of experience that he knows, you know, that line he has to take to get to where he needs to. So I think as you get older in officiating and a step slower, you learn how to use your smarts you've created over the years to create the sight lines. And be honest with you, in some ways, I think as we get older, because you've learned that, you're actually better at it. But eventually you lose another step and then it's just time to come off the ice.
Now, taking another page out of your autobiography, soon-to-be autobiography, let's say the physical components are there. Let's say the understanding of the game is there, but how does one crack his way into the National Hockey League?
Well, it's changed a little bit now in terms of how they do things from when I came through, but it's repetition. I mean, the one thing I think is a little bit harder now, Martin, is, you know, when I came through, you know, 20, like every night was hard, right? Because it was a physical game and we had fighting and we had stuff every night. I mean, the way the game is today is played at such a skill that we don't get tested as much maybe when we're in the juniors and the minor pros as we used to. So I think the learning curve is a little bit longer sometimes, but certainly it's repetition. It's just doing games and, you know, learning where to be, learning the sight lines. And then once we've done all those things we talked about earlier, then it's experience and, you know, the tough nights and dealing with tough coaches and tough players. And quite honestly, like in this business, you're going to fail at some point. You're going to have a game where you've just made a mess of the game. And then that's the ability up here to respond. So, you know, I quite often, you know, you don't like it to happen, but if you're going to watch a guy work two nights in a row in the junior league and he's not very good the first night, screw something up, and you can sit with him and coach him and see how he responds like the next night mentally, then, you know, he have something. Cause honestly, some guys can't respond the next night. Like once they have a tough night, they just overanalyze. And unfortunately in this business, a lot like a player, I guess, you know what, you can analyze it and do your thing in the morning, but by noon the next day, you better be done with it and ready for that night.
We're talking about the physical aspect. You were slowly but steadily getting into the psychological aspect of things, and you were also talking about communication. At what point do you know as a referee that you're good at communicating? It might sound like a very basic skill, but is there ever a point where you think, I got this, or I've got a feel for this?
Yeah, I think at some point you get better at it and then you realize that you're, you know, and I think what's important is communication is one of the things we can work on in our whole life, like on or off the ice. So, I mean, there's many nights where I came off the ice, I thought to myself, okay, I could have done that different, right? I could have, you know, so by the end, I think I'm pretty good at it, but, you know, I still know that there's things that I can learn when I'm communicating, especially now for me in the role I'm in. But I think communication's ever evolving, but I do think it's something you can improve on in your daily life.
I still remember the days where we had the old refereeing approach. I vividly remember that one of the points of emphasis was to get referees and players on kind of a first name basis. Is that one of the stepping stones? And if so, what are other stepping stones in improving player, referee, coaches communication?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's important, you know, the coaches' names and your key players, right? And over time, and like the guy working in the ice league, would know most of the players because they see him over and over again. So I think to humanize it, right? And I mean, it doesn't always have to be about hockey, right? Sometimes, you know, you're standing on a timeout or something, and it doesn't hurt to ask a guy how he's doing or how his family's doing, right? And I think, you know, we have to, sometimes in a game, opportunities arise where we're just going to naturally communicate with people. Sometimes it doesn't hurt to manufacture those, right? To, you know, go over and say something to a goalie about a save he's made, or, you know, go over and early in the night, go over to coach and say, hey, how are we doing tonight? Just here to help you work a line changes. Anything comes up, let me know. Like there's ways that we can manufacture communication to build rapport, right? And sometimes it just naturally occurs within a game.
Are these conversations almost always superficial, or is there a point where you think, okay, now I've really hit a soft spot with this player and coach?
Well, they're not superficial. And some players, and part of it is reading players that don't want to be engaged with you. And that's fine, because some don't want to talk to referees or other players. But like you, when I think back to my career, there's a lot of players that you knew for a long, long time. And when you did ask them how their Christmas was, and there were some that asked you all the time. So it gets to a point over time where, I mean, you're never going to be friends because you're business associates. You might run into them in a hotel and you might have, and they might be really good people, but when you're at the rank, you're business associates. But you get to the point where, yeah, I think there's an understanding from a lot of players that this is a business that we're all in together and we all want to be successful. So there's a lot of really good people that generally wonder how you're doing, for sure.
Now, as it's a business, and as referees and players ideally are business partners, has there been one player where you do think you had a very good report?
Sure. And there'd be lots over the course of your career, right? And you know, early in my pro career, like a lot of guys you came through junior with are now, so you're starting the National League together with these young guys. We're all nervous. So you almost become people you talk to each other because you're comfortable, because you've worked in the Western League or the American League together. And then over time, there's just some players that, you know, I was a guy, like I said, like to communicate. And so you do, you become those guys that are easier for you to talk to, because, and the guy that might be easy for me to talk to may not be for the other referee, right? And that's all same in life, right? So, but for sure, there's some that just become, you know, there's nights where I'd work in the National Hockey League and there'd be guys that be happy to see you, right? Because they knew you were a guy that they knew and could talk to and joke if you had to as well, if the timing was right.
Now, a lot of people, of course, watch the NHL. You've been officiating the league games for quite some time, more than 1,100 games, if I'm informed correctly. What's the very first memory that comes to mind when thinking back of the very first NHL game that you officiated?
Well, I think you're scared, right? It's a big step. And my first game was actually in Carolina. And so when Carolina became a team, they moved from Hartford, but they had to play 2 years in, I think it was Greensboro, before the rink was done. So my first game was the first game in that building there now. And so you're in the day before and went over to look at the rink, because it's brand new. They were telling us we probably wouldn't play because they didn't think the rink was going to be done, right? They were that close. So, yeah, I think it's kind of a blur. The one nice thing that's really changed is when I started. So I went to my first game and did my thing. Now we actually invite the family. So the young referee's mom and dad would come, or wife or whatever, and they'd come to the game and be able to experience that whole thing with them afterwards, and, you know, have a beer in the room and meet the guys. So I think we've evolved as an officials association, but I think probably for me, I think it's a blur because you're so excited to finally get in the NHL, but you're scared a little bit to get through it. So, but certainly an exciting night for sure.
Now, you're getting great at consistently and constantly on the refereeing job you do in the NHL. For all the people who don't know the process, how does it work? How many people look at referees, look at the what they do, and how does this kind of grading sheet look like?
Well, it's certainly changed over the years, right? Like all hockey has. So at the start, there would be, you know, six or seven supervisors that would be in different rinks at different times. And you know, we called them supervisors, but they were coaches as well. I mean, nowadays, everything's on TV. So, I mean, there's still those six or seven officiating managers, they're called now, buildings and coming afterwards. And their role is kind of a coaching role, similar to mine, especially for the younger officials in the NHL. But then every game, you know, there's a war room in Toronto that's watching all the games from an officiating standpoint and player safety standpoint. There's a war room in New York too, watching more so player safety. So, I mean, honestly, nowadays in the NHL, nothing is missed. After a game on your iPad or laptop, whatever you have, you would have all your calls, all your miss or marginal calls be clipped. So, I mean, it has changed so much that in a lot of ways it's good. It goes back to what I said earlier, is you got to be pretty strong now when everything you do is magnified on TV every night. But if you're mentally strong and you approach it the right way from a coaching standpoint, then it's certainly a positive thing.
Mental strength being one of the key words. How mentally tough, if you can put it in words, do you have to be? And is it advisable sometimes to seek outside assistance in trying to get mentally tough?
For sure. I think, you know, it's basically a team of four every night now with everything's four-man system. But you got to be mentally strong. Like, and you're mentally strong for the days that you do screw up, right? Because like I said earlier, you have to come back the next night and be better. You got to be mentally strong for the nights where you're good, but the guy in the paper says you're not, the guy on TV says you're not, all those things. So you can rely on your buddies. Like when times get hard, you rely on your buddies and the guys you work with and the guys in the room. But at the end of the day, when you go back to your hotel room by yourself, you have to be mentally strong. When I think of all the guys that I came through with, there are some really, really good referees that got to a certain level, and then they never made that next step because it was just too hard mentally for them, right? So, and being a confidence person, and that's always tough too. I mean, I think you have to have a lot of confidence to do this job. And unfortunately, sometimes you walk that line of arrogance, right? And you don't want to ever become that arrogant person. So, but it's right on that line, right? And we've all crossed it at times. But if you can figure out where confidence and arrogance just kind of collide, you're in a good spot.
You remember the very first instance where you, during your active career, said to a player, a coach, a team, maybe a journalist, "Sorry, I screwed this call up. It's on me."
I can't remember the first time, but I can remember doing it. I think it's so important because we all make mistakes. So when they happen, I mean, the ability to say to a coach or a player, like, you know what, I screwed that up, right? I apologize. Nobody feels worse than me. It's important, right? Because to say to somebody, "No, I'm right, you're wrong," when you know, like, you lose credibility. Like, and nowadays, like I said, with everything on TV, I mean, you're going to go and look the next day and say, "Oh, coach is right." So you hope that you see that team or that player so you can say to them, right? And the other thing sometimes is, like, if it happens a lot, it's not a good thing. But there's times in the ice where you call a penalty and you think to yourself, "Oh boy." Like, the good referees know at the time they didn't want it. So hopefully they don't score on a power play and you can say to the player, "Hey, sorry."
I want to get into detail as regards the officiating part, but also obviously you being on the ice with some all-time greats. Is there ever a point where you're kind of in awe because you think, like, okay, this player just skated past me? And if you ever experienced it, when and with whom was it?
For sure. And early in your career, right? Because as you get older, they kind of come in. But I mean, imagine a Canadian kid getting on the ice with Wayne Gretzky the first time, or Mario Lemieux. So those moments are like, yeah, for sure. You're kind of starstruck, and then you realize the moment you have to kind of, you know, do your job. And, you know, and then over the course of time, you have conversations with those guys, or Marc Messier, and you think to yourself, "Holy cow, I can do this." And, you know, a guy like Marc Messier and Gretzky, those guys, they were very receptive to the young referees. You know, they tested you like everybody does, but they accepted you too, which made a difference. So, but yeah, I can remember my first time with, I'm sure I called him Mr. Gretzky, and yeah, certainly a very, you know, you're starstruck, right? He's Wayne Gretzky.
Did you ever have to send Gretzky or Messier or Lemieux to the penalty box? And if so, how did that feel?
Yeah, I don't remember Gretzky. Lemieux for sure, right? And yeah, I mean, I think probably felt fine, right? Because they were good calls. I don't think I screwed those ones up. But yeah, certainly different when you're young in the business.
Now, apart from being starstruck, who's been a quote-unquote handful to deal with. Who's been one of the more interesting characters as a player on the ice that did you have to deal with?
Well, I think there was lots probably through the course of my career that were challenges at times, right? And I think of some goaltenders that were a little bit of work. But, you know, those guys that challenge you, the great thing about the National Hockey League is, you know, at times on TV, it looks like we take a lot of heat. And there are times we do, but for the most part, they understand and have a respect. Like, very rarely did pro players cross that line you shouldn't cross. So there'd always be a few that were a little bit more, but, you know, you think of some of those guys and how they had to play that role, right? They had to play on the edge and they had to. So at the end of the day, they weren't really mad at you. They have to play like that to be successful. So yeah, there'd be a lot of guys like that.
Now, obviously, coach and referee communication, a very vital part as well. How does it differ as regards the referee and player communication?
Well, I think, you know, certainly there's a lot more one-on-one interaction with the players, right? Because you can, you know, you're out on the ice together, maybe in a line change, and you can send that message you want to send to that player. There's a time we can have a, you know, a good conversation, sometimes a joke conversation, but be a little bit more one-on-one. Whereas the coaches, even though it's one-on-one, it's in front of 20 players, right? So that can be a little different because you're still trying to send a message to the coach and the team. And there's times where he's trying to send you a message. You never know, or you do know as you move along and understand coaches and how they work, but it's a different dynamic because it's never one-on-one.
Now, we talked about the communication players and referees on the ice, but in what regard does communication change when it's coaches and referees?
Well, it's a little bit different with the coaches. Certainly those conversations, just remember, they're done at the bench, so they're done in front of their 20 players. So certainly sometimes that affects their role and their thought process. You know, and I think it's important as an official that you understand, are they mad at you? Are they mad at the game? Are they mad at where their team is? And sometimes emotions from coaches, it isn't about them being mad at the official. They might be trying to fire their team up. And I think so it's an understanding a little bit of where the coach is coming from. And then I think what's really important is you never want to embarrass anybody and you never want to be embarrassed. So when you go over and deal with a coach, you got to make sure you deal with them in a respectful way and in a way that nobody gets embarrassed or nobody gets shown up and that everybody leaves there with, you know, a sense that we got to a point where we needed to get to. We can still be mad and pissed off at each other, but there's still a respect on both sides there.
When talking about your NHL career, how much preparation did go into a game? How much homework did you do on the coaches, on the players? Which player might be a handful?
Yeah, certainly that's the one thing that we did a lot of in our careers. And easier as the years went along. But you always, you know, and even at lunch, it would start with the team, right? With our four officials, you'd talk about, you know, the coaches or the players or, you know, is there a team that's struggling and certain players that are clearly struggling or players are acting differently because they are frustrated. So did a lot of homework for sure. And I think as I got near the end of my career, you know, everybody had a cell phone, a computer, you'd talk. So you always knew what was kind of happening with teams and players before you went into that night. And I think that's important because, you know, if a team's 0-7, you know that they're going to be cranky. Right. So, you know, we have to understand that dealing with them might be a little different that night. And, you know, everybody, when pressure falls on people, they react differently. So sometimes just you have to understand that, hey, that guy's under pressure. Right. So normally the guy that's an easy guy to deal with isn't. So you have to find a way to deal with them that night and understand that it's, you know, it's not personal. It's business.
Talked about the players that you dealt with, but which coach was always someone you'd be looking forward to talking to now from other leagues, obviously the likes of Bill Belichick and Greg Popovich come to mind who could be interesting to deal with. Who would that equivalent be for you and the National Hockey League?
Well, there are some really good coaches over the years, right? I mean, Scotty Bowman was obviously a very smart hockey man, right? And, you know, you never knew where Scotty was coming from because he was such a smart man and where his mind was in the game, right? Joel Quenneville is one of those guys that I just think the coach, right? You know, Mike Keenan certainly was a different kind of personality to deal with, right? And so you had to approach those ones differently. But, you know, over the course of my career, there wasn't too many that I really battled with, but I certainly enjoyed, you know, I can think of Joel for sure. Sometimes you just giggle when you're done talking to him, right? Because he got his point across in a way that you both kind of enjoyed. And but you did have to prepare for those guys. Like, you know, I tell the young guys now that when you go to the bench to talk to a coach, you better be prepared, right? Because you know they are.
How did the transition go from you calling it a career to we used the word stumble before, but maybe to stumble into the role of a development coach? Was it always something that you aspired, or did it just happen?
Kind of happened. I knew when I came off the ice, I probably wanted to stay in a game. I had some other things I thought about doing, but the Western Hockey League, which is one of the major junior leagues in Canada, of the three, they approached me my last year on the ice and said, hey, why don't you start doing a few things? And I always had done stuff for them in terms of helping them in the summer, the development camps and going to the odd game. So it kind of evolved for me, and they were good. They created a job when I came off the ice and were very good to me. And honestly, I mean, I think, you know, I thought I would be really good at it. And I think I am. And I think I'm getting better at it, but it's such a different role. Like, there's nights that I walk out of a rink and think, okay, I could have handled that better with the officiating team. I could have handled that better with the coaches when I talk to them. So this is 3 years into this role now. You know, I've even started to take some of a buddy of mine who's, he was a superintendent of schools and a principal and a really good educators. So I take him sometimes and he sits in the room with me when I talk to the guys, and then he kind of gives me some thoughts on how I can be better. So, you kind of evolve into it. I love it. I love being around the game, love being around the officials. But you know what? It's like anything, Martin, you got to continue to work at what you're doing to get better. So, and one of the things about being here is things are a little different. And I'm a guy that can get excited and ramble on. And even in Canada, sometimes guys don't understand me. So, you know, I got to slow myself down here a little bit and understand that English isn't a first language for a lot of our officials. So, I mean, that's a good learning curve for me, right? To work better at my skills communicating with them. So,
talking a little bit about the roles, and most of them have been set in stone for decades now. There have been tweaks to it. The offside rule finally according to some of the people changed in the NHL. Is there a rule twist, a rule tweak that from an official standpoint you kind of want to see?
You know what, for me, the game has changed a lot and we seem to tweak it a lot. I think, you know, some I agree with, some I don't. But I think for the most part, the game's a good place. I think what's important is the dangerous place, right? And I think one that's creeping into hockey a little bit is a high speed kind of push in the back, right? And they play, the game is so fast right now that sometimes that's all it takes for somebody to get hurt. So I think we have to be a little careful with those, because there's no intent for most of the time, right? It's just, but I think as long as we stay diligent with aggressive, dangerous plays, you know, the hits to the head, which I think all leagues are doing a good job with. They're hard. I mean, they're hard on the ice to see. I mean, you have to have a good sight line. You have to, because you don't want the guys guessing. So, you know, unfortunately, sometimes we don't get those right. And that's what, you know, DOPS is for. But I think if we just really work hard to make the game, the game is so fast and entertaining right now. And that's where we want to stay, right on that edge. And we want to allow, we don't want to take physicality out of it, because we like the hitting, because it's a skill we need. So we want to get that game right to the edge and then be able to recognize that we need those dangerous fouls out of the game. And I think, you know, for the most part, the leagues, including the Ice League, are doing a good job of that.
Now, if you take away the hits into the back and they're awfully tough to see and awfully tough to officiate, what's been the toughest calls on a regular basis that you had to make that are awfully tough for officials to make? Is it the slashing? Is it the hooking? Is it the spearing? What comes to mind first?
You know, the one that I find that without a doubt, the easiest call in hockey to make as a referee is a high stick. And without a doubt, the easiest call to miss in hockey for a referee is a high stick. They're just so quick nowadays, right? And you know, the players are so good with their sticks and trying to keep them out of the hands and the hooking and holding. So we've taken so many things out of the game that they used to be able to do. So now the sticks and the sticks are lighter and move quick. So you can imagine that guy turns his back to you for a split second and you can't, you know, does that stick get him, you know, in the hand? Does it get him, ride him up in the face? So, you know, you get that question from coaches sometimes, how did you miss a high stick? And I'm like, okay, we shouldn't have, and we don't like to, but sometimes they're just the easy, for whatever reason, the easiest ones to miss.
Now, the old saying goes, as a referee, never watch the puck. Do you really never watch the puck? Is it always about the players all the time? Or isn't it that black and white?
You're pretty close. Like, you know, and that's one of the things I find with young officials, you got to teach them not to watch the puck all the time, right? I mean, linesmen are going to watch the puck. They can help you when it goes out of play and things like that. But referees got to watch from the waist up. The only time that really changes is if you can think when the play gets close to the net. So the referee who's low, close to the net, he needs to come in. And that's when we use the term puck focused. And that's when he has to become puck focused, because the most important thing is the scoring of a goal. So we have to make sure we know where the puck is. We have to make sure we know when it's covered. So, you know, in that 10-foot area, whatever you want to call it, that's when you become puck focused. And the great thing about two referees on the ice is, so what we teach him is when it goes to the net, you know, your partner has to become puck focused. And as you imagine, your vision's way out here. And when you come closer to something, your vision becomes narrower. So that's when the back official has to kind of make sure he's more alert, kind of around the outside of the crease. But yeah, for sure, puck focused only at the net.
How does this communication work as you've are a big proponent of communication and preferably you work in teams, you come together on or during lunchtime already, you prepare for the game. How does the on-ice conversation work? How much of a say does a lineman really, really have when it's two referees arguing about a call?
Well, you know what, the thing is, it is four guys on the ice, and that's why important we develop the linesmen as well, so that they're seeing the game and not just being just, you know, doing their job, calling offsides and icings. They need to see the game for a lot of different reasons. But, you know, when something happens and we huddle together, certainly the one referee is going to take the lead on a conversation and walk us through it. But, and certainly linesmen that have been around a little bit more, right, and created the credibility, their input and their view on things is just as important. At the end of the day, you know, the referees, if they're split, they're going to really go with what their opinion is. But it's really important that we develop linesmen that see the game and understand the game so they can help in those hard spots.
One aspect I've always been fascinated by, and people see it in the National Hockey League, but also in the Better Home Ice Hockey League, every time we get to the playoffs, it seems as if it's a whole different game. It's faster, it's more physical, but and then that's just an estimate, but the penalties don't necessarily go up. How do you prepare for that faster, more physical pace, and how do you try to still call it right down the line, even though it might be a completely different game than the one that's played in the regular season?
Yes, that's a great question. It is a different game. So we have to make sure that our guys will be prepared, right, mentally, and understand the pressure and understand the ebb and flow of the game and the series. And, you know, you hear all the time that officiating changes in playoffs. It might a little, like we might let them play a little bit more, but I think what aspects missed is the player change. I mean, they understand what's on the line, how important the games are, and they play, you know. And so, you know, in a 7-game series, yeah, you're going to have some tough stuff and have to step up and make some calls and things like that. But like the game changes because the players change and understand it too. And they don't want to put their team in a bad spot. So that's a beautiful thing about playoff hockey is it, you know, I talked earlier about getting the game right to the edge. Playoff hockey gets right to the edge. And I always use the terminology is you run your horses right to the edge of the cliff, and the really good referees can get their horse or the game right to the edge of the cliff and then just pull back on the reins and bring them right back to that great place for the games, fast and physical and fair. And that's the beautiful thing about playoff hockey. And I do think that the players respond.
talked about it before. 1,100 games in your career officiating in the National Hockey League. Is it the body of work that you're most proud of, or is there a single call, a single game, a single instance where you say, "Wow, this was really a great call at the right time against, or in a high pressure situation"?
Yeah, I think there's games you remember, calls you remember, but I think when I look back at my career, I think, I pride myself that I was a good teammate. And I think at the end of the day, that you always want to, no matter what you do, you want to have more. But I think at the end of the day, when I left the business, I was pretty proud of the teammate I was and who I was and the friendships I made along the way.
If this quote unquote mission that you're here for concludes, what's the one thing that you want to see refs doing? Is there one thing that you're actively looking for, or is it just the process that you try to start?
Yeah, I think for me, there's a couple things that I think are really important to create a base in terms of sight lines and things like that. And like I said, I'd watched a lot of games for Lyle on TV, and I know Greg has, and I think we've made some real good strides that way. So now I just, being in the room and talking about their thought process. Okay, why did you do this then? So I think just trying to get them moving along that scale of the game management or the understanding of the game and just the thought process, right? So, and the thing is about, a staff like they have here in the Ice League, there's some younger guys and some older guys, so those conversations are completely different, but it's exciting. I've seen a couple of guys twice now, and you go in, you talk to them the first night about a couple of things you want them to try. And I'm a firm believer in saying, listen, I think this would help you try it. And if it doesn't, let's try something different. Cause my way isn't always right for different guys, but I've seen some guys try things the next night or 3 days later and it work. And then again, I've seen it not work for certain guys, but it's so much fun to see them trying. And then you have that conversation after that game and they like part of it. They didn't like all of it. So how do we move to a point that's perfect for that official? So that's the one thing about this job. It's great when you see them progressing and engaged.
Looking forward to seeing that happen on the ice. And thank you so much for taking the time educating me and obviously people out there on refereeing so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Was macht das perfekte Fahrerlebnis aus? Hocheffiziente Motoren? Innovative Mild-Hybrid-Technologie? Ein Elektroantrieb? All das und mehr. Ein einzigartiges Fahrgefühl, das begeistert. Die neuen Mazda-Modelle. Jetzt mit 1.000 Euro Online-Bonus. Fordern Sie jetzt ein Angebot an oder buchen Sie eine Probefahrt auf Mazda.at und profitieren Sie von unserem Online-Bonus. Mit 1.000 Euro zusätzlich zu anderen Angeboten sparen Sie damit bis zu 6.900 Euro beim Mazda-Modell Ihrer Wahl. Jetzt auf mazda.at.
Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfanner im dritten und wahrscheinlich beliebtesten Teil. Und das liegt natürlich auch an der Dame, die mir gegenüber sitzt. Der dritte Teil gehört immer den Puls24 Experten und in der Rotation einmal mehr Terry Hornig zu Gast. Terry, freue mich sehr, dass du die Zeit für Hockey O'Clock nimmst.
Freut mich auch, wieder hier zu sein.
Terry, wir zeichnen das nach dem Puls24 Live-Spiel Wien gegen Salzburg auf. Was wird nach dem 4:2-Sieg der Red Bulls von diesem Spiel übrig bleiben?
Bei mir wird auf jeden Fall in Erinnerung bleiben, dass die Salzburger den besseren Start gehabt haben, die Wiener in den letzten Spielen schon öfter den Start verschlafen haben, nicht optimal gestartet sind. Sie haben dann zwar den Ausgleich noch geschafft, sind zurückgekommen, aber Salzburg hat dann in Summe verdient gewonnen. Sie wollten es mehr, sie haben die Kleinigkeiten besser und konsequenter gemacht.
Was sagt sie über die Motivationsskills von Terry Hornig aus, wenn sie in der Vorberichterstattung Austin Ortega anmahnt, mehr zu produzieren und der dann förmlich explodiert und einen Doppelpack hinlegt?
Ja, das war schon sehr schön anzuschauen, dass er dann endlich auch seine Tore schießen kann.
Sind die Verstärkungen, wir haben es auch im Rahmen der Vorberichterstattung angesprochen, ganz spannend, weil Wien auf einen großen, kräftigen Spieler mit Darren Archibald setzt, während Austin Ortega eher der kleine Wuselige ist. Was sagt das vielleicht auch über die Philosophien der Teams aus oder was vielleicht jeweils gefehlt hat?
Ich denke, dass beide Teams versucht haben, das zu ergänzen, was bis jetzt noch ein bisschen gefehlt hat. Wien spielt sehr gerne mit Schüssen von außen, Abfälschen, viel Verkehr vor dem Tor. Und da ist Archibald sicher der richtige Spieler, der durch seine Größe gute Sicht verstellen kann und auch Rebounds verwerten kann. Und Ortega bei Salzburg, einer, der viele Tore schießen kann, der auch produziert. Und das hat bei den Salzburgern in den letzten Spielen nicht optimal geklappt.
Weil aber eben Darren Archibald jemand ist, der vors Tor gehen kann. Warum mahnt Jérôme Leduc das dann am Ende der Drittelpause an und sagt, wir müssen mehr vors Tor bringen? Hat dir das heute gefehlt?
Ja, also sie können das auf jeden Fall sehr gut, dass sie vor das Tor gehen. Manchmal machen sie es aber nicht. Und das sind dann diese Kleinigkeiten, die für die Wiener Spiele entscheidend sein können.
Wir wollen einen kleinen Blick in die Liga werfen. Ein paar Spiele sind auch noch am Laufen, wenngleich es jetzt für Klagenfurt mit dem 4:2 gegen Dornbirn. Das Spiel läuft noch ganz gut. Aussieht, dass Salzburg auch hier heute schon die Playoff-Quali fix einsackeln kann. Größte Überraschung des Spieltags für dich, der Sieg von Graz über Bozen?
Ja, für mich ist Bozen eine sehr starke Mannschaft. Im letzten Spiel hat es bei ihnen schon nicht optimal geklappt gegen Fehervar, wo sie extrem viele Tore bekommen haben, nach den Schlagzeilen, dass sie defensiv so gut sind. Und auch heute gegen Graz wieder verloren, hätte ich mir nicht erwartet.
Wie groß ist vielleicht die Gefahr, auch die Playoff-Qualifikation so früh in der Tasche zu haben? Das ist bei Bozen der Fall, das ist bei Wien der Fall. Kann sich da dann eben auch der Schlendrian einschleichen, wenn man weiß, man hat jetzt bis Mitte März keinen Druck gewinnen zu müssen?
Das kann sicherlich so sein, dass man dann sagt, okay, wir spielen jetzt ohne Druck. Es ist auch ein kleiner Erfolg, der dann schon erreicht ist und auf dem kann man sich ein bisschen ausruhen, sollte man natürlich nicht. Es geht um die Vorbereitung auf die Playoffs und da wäre das schon ganz wichtig, dass man mit viel Selbstvertrauen starten kann.
Wie war das in deiner Karriere? Es wird zwar nicht allzu viele Spiele gegeben haben, in denen es um gar nichts ging, aber wenn es mal dazu kam, wie bist du in diese Partie gegangen?
Auch mit weniger Druck. Also bei mir war es dann eher so, dass ich mir persönliche Ziele gesetzt habe, also einen Gegentorschnitt von unter 2 oder was auch immer. Aber man nimmt das Ganze dann schon ein bisschen lockerer. Und für mich persönlich war es so, dass ich mit Druck eigentlich besser gespielt habe.
Alles klar. Wir gehen jetzt mal davon aus, dass die Tabellenteilung mit dem heutigen Sonntag vollzogen ist, dass die fixen Playoff-Teams Bozen, Klagenfurt, Fehervar, Wien und Salzburg sein werden. Das bringt uns zum Überlebenskampf unten in der Qualifikationsrunde. Welchen dieser sechs Teams traust du am ehesten den Sprung in die Playoffs zu? Und wir gehen jetzt einfach mal davon aus, Dornbirn holt sich das Punkte-Maximum, wenngleich das auch noch nicht entschieden ist. Aber welcher dieser sechs Teams traust du den Sprung in die Playoffs zu? Drei Namen, beziehungsweise drei Teamnamen.
Drei Teamnamen, okay. Dornbirn hat einen riesen Vorteil durch die Bonuspunkte.
Wenn es so bleibt.
Wenn es so bleibt, die würde ich dann ganz sicher dazu zählen. Wer meiner Meinung nach sehr gut spielt, ist Bratislava und auch Villach ist am aufsteigenden Weg.
Das wäre auf jeden Fall ein hochinteressantes Teilnehmerfeld, bis es soweit ist. Wird aber dann Gott sei Dank auch noch sehr viel Eishockey gespielt werden, dass wir Ihnen euch natürlich auf Puls 24 auch kredenzen dürfen. Eigentlich wäre in zwei Wochen National Team Break bzw. International Break. Für das Herren-Nationalteam wurde der abgesagt. Die Battle Home Eishockey League nutzt diesen Termin auch, um gleich weiterzuspielen. Also die Teams, wenn man so will, ein wenig im Rhythmus zu halten und uns mehr Platzierungs- und Qualifikationsrunden-Hockey zu bieten. Nicht aber so beim Frauen-Eishockey. Was erwartet die Fans da im International Break?
Also es wird bei den Damen-Nationalmannschaften zwei Camps geben. Das eine ist das Damen-A-Nationalteam, also die Senioren, die in Wien ein Trainingslager haben mit zwei Spielen gegen Kasachstan. Und zeitgleich wird die U17-Nationalmannschaft, also die nächstjährige U18, die dann bei der Heimweltmeisterschaft antritt, in Villach ein Camp haben mit zwei Spielen gegen die Schweiz.
Ich möchte beim A-Nationalteam der Frauen kurz ansetzen. Spannender der Kader. Was ist dir bei der Nominierung von oder den Nominierungen von Jage Risco aufgefallen?
Es ist eigentlich ein relativ ähnlicher Kader wie bisher. Janine Weber natürlich nicht dabei, weil sie einfach zu weit weg ist. Und sonst ist es nach wie vor ein sehr junger Kader mit einigen Ausnahmen und ganz viele junge, talentierte Spieler, die in Zukunft sicher noch zu Leistungsträgerinnen werden.
Wer deinen Ausführungen beim letzten Mal Frauen-Eishockey-Talk nicht ganz gelauscht hat. Wen muss man so auf der Rechnung haben? Wer sind so die Führungsspielerinnen? Fangen wir mal im Tor an. Wen muss man da auf der Rechnung haben?
Also im Tor für mich eine sehr talentierte junge Spielerin, Jahrgang 2002 geboren, ist Selma Lugin, die letztes Jahr bei der U18-Weltmeisterschaft sehr gut gespielt hat. Ich glaube, es waren 3 Shutouts in 5 Spielen und insgesamt nur 3 Gegentore. Also sie ist dort auch beste Torhüterin des Turniers geworden und war, wie gesagt, letztes Jahr noch U18. Also da ist noch sehr viel Entwicklungspotenzial vorhanden.
Bist du als Teammanagerin in einem deiner 100 Jobs für die U17-Nationalmannschaft unter anderem verantwortlich? Da findet sich ebenfalls der Name Lugin, ebenfalls eine Torfrau. Da scheint sehr viel Talent, sehr viel Torhütertalent in der Familie Lugin zu sein. Ein Wort zu Magdalena Lugin, die in deinem Team quasi dann spielt und steht?
Magdalena Lugin, eine sehr großgewachsene Torfrau, Jahrgang 2005, also noch sehr jung, hat letztes Jahr auch schon an der U18-Weltmeisterschaft teilgenommen, hat noch nichts gespielt, war aber bei jedem Spiel auf der Bank und hat dort bewiesen, was für eine professionelle Einstellung sie hat und dass sie ganz sicher ihren Weg gehen wird. Und auch bei den Youth Olympic Games mit der Goldmedaille hat sie ordentlich aufgezeigt.
Wir bleiben noch ein wenig beim Damen-Nationalteam. Wenn man sich den Roster so anschaut, dann ist wahrscheinlich der Dreh- und Angelpunkt, auch nachdem sie weiterhin die Schweden-Bombe ist, in Anführungszeichen, und dort alles zerschießt, Anna Meixner. Ist sie die Spielerin, die hier vorangehen muss?
Sie ist ganz sicher eine Spielerin, die Punkte machen kann, die durch ihren Speed in jedem Spiel auffällt und wahnsinnig gefährlich ist in der Offensive, also gefährlich für die gegnerische Mannschaft natürlich. Aber sie hat auch einige gute Mitspielerinnen, mit denen sie sicher gut zusammenspielen kann. Also da haben wir zum Beispiel die Eva Beiter, die schon eine Spur älter ist als der Durchschnitt der Mannschaft, aber auch immer wieder sehr gute Spiele abliefert. Dann Anna Hansa oder ganz jung, Jahrgang 2004, Emma Hofbauer, die jetzt im Sturm dabei sind, aber auch Eva Verworner, Esther Werele, Monika Wilczek, also es gibt ganz viele Namen, die hier wirklich im Sturm top abliefern können.
Auf wen beim Damen-A-Nationalteam freust du dich am meisten? Bei wem bist du auch gespannt auf die Leistungen?
Ich denke, dass es da nicht sonderlich viele Überraschungen gibt. Ganz besonders spannend für mich zu beobachten ist einfach die Entwicklung der Torhüterinnen. Und ich hoffe, dass da auch Anja Adamitsch zu ihren Einsätzen kommt. Die habe ich nämlich beim letzten Einsatz leider nicht sehen können und ist sicher auch ein Top-Talent. Genauso wie Jessica Eckert, also auf der Torhüterposition, die Österreicherinnen sicher sehr gut aufgestellt.
Wie ist Kasachstan zu bewerten? Was ist da für Team Austria zu holen? Geht man als Underdog in die Spiele oder mit offenem Visier, weil man eigentlich ja, sich durchaus Chancen ausrechnet?
Das ist im Damen-Eishockey immer ganz schwer zu sagen, weil man nie weiß, ob die mit ihrem besten Kader kommen können, wie viele Spielerinnen im Ausland sind, ob die dieses Jahr speziell Covid-19-bedingt im Ausland überhaupt sind, ob die einreisen dürfen, also mit welcher Mannschaft hier angetreten wird. Aber grundsätzlich sehe ich die Österreicherinnen doch als Favorit in dieser Begegnung.
Du hast viele Funktionen inne, bist ausgebildete Physiotherapeutin, hast Sportmanagement studiert, bist im Teammanagement beim Verband, beim Frauen-Eishockey tätig. Du bist TV-Expertin, absolute Tausend-Sassa-in, wenn man so will. Aber was ist deine Aufgabe konkret, wenn sich da liest, Terry Hornig, Teammanagement, Damen, U17-Nationalteam?
Ich sehe mich da ein bisschen als Schnittstelle vor Ort bei den Camps zwischen dem Kader oder dem Staff vor Ort, also das Coaching-Team, die Spielerinnen und dem Verband, der dann in Wien ist. Ich bin natürlich aber genauso bei den Vorbereitungen beteiligt in der Kommunikation mit anderen Nationen, dass so ein Camp gut vorbereitet wird und dann auch gut ablaufen kann.
Was sind da so die größten Herausforderungen?
Derzeit Hotels zu finden, weil die grundsätzlich ja eher geschlossen sind zur derzeitigen Zeit. Aber ich glaube, das haben wir halbwegs hinbekommen.
Wenn es dann in Richtung Nominierung geht, Flo Mühlstein, der Head Coach dieses Teams, guter alter Bekannter in der Liga, Benny Schennach als Assistant Coach, wie gestalten sich diese Nominierungen? Wird da auch von dir Input geholt oder machen die das ganz autark?
Normalerweise machen das die Head Coaches allein und ich mische mich da so wenig wie möglich ein. Nachdem allerdings Mühlstein und Schennach jetzt das erste Mal dabei sind beim Damen-Nationalteam in der U17, haben die den Überblick wahrscheinlich noch nicht so über alle Spielerinnen, die es gibt. Sie haben natürlich die vergangenen Kader gesehen, aber jetzt ist wieder ein Jahr später und da sollten auch neue Spielerinnen eine Chance bekommen. Und deshalb haben wir da auch Eva Verwarner ein bisschen eingebunden in die Vorbereitungen, die letztes Jahr U16 Head Coach war, um dann wirklich die besten Spielerinnen auszuwählen und die, die wir uns unbedingt einmal anschauen wollen.
Wen willst du dir unbedingt ansehen? Auf wen bist du gespannt? Ohne jetzt Druck zu erzeugen, einfach nur, auf wen darf man sich freuen aus U17, U18 Nationalmannschaftssicht?
Es gibt da ganz viele Namen, die wirklich Top-Talente sind. Es gibt auch einige Spielerinnen, die in der Erwachsenenliga schon aufgezeigt haben. Für mich spannend zu sehen sind vor allem die Spielerinnen aus dem Westen, weil ich die im Umkreis von Wien nicht so gut sehen kann. Und da gibt es dann einige, auf die ich mich besonders freue, wobei in diesem Kader eigentlich kein einziger Name ist, wo ich sage, die habe ich noch nie gesehen oder da weiß ich gar nicht, wie sie spielt. Also es sind eigentlich alles alte Bekannte.
Gibt den Eishockey-Fans doch ein, zwei Namen, auf wen es sich lohnt, vielleicht dann nicht heute, vielleicht dann auch nicht während dem Camp, aber dann vielleicht in Zukunft zu blicken?
Ja, also die Top-Spielerinnen aus dem U17-Nationalteam, die sind die bei diesem Camp allerdings schon beim A-Team dabei. Aber im Tor ist es ganz sicher Magdalena Lugin, auf die man da schauen kann. Auch Anna Biller ist eine junge, talentierte Spielerin, die ist überhaupt erst Jahrgang 2006. Also die hat da noch mehrere Jahre in der U17. Verena Haselsteiner, Leonie Kutzer. Also es gibt dann schon ganz viele, die wirklich gut sind. Auch Lena Artner darf man nicht unterschätzen. Hanna Obermeier. Also es gibt dann wirklich einige Spielerinnen. Ich könnte eigentlich den ganzen Kader vorlesen.
Ja, wer jetzt nicht genannt worden ist, bitte nicht böse sein. Wir haben ja keine Zeit. Eigentlich schon. Aber cool, dass wir ein paar Namen von dir serviert und präsentiert bekommen. Es geht so ein wenig in dieselbe Richtung, wie das Roger Bader auch beim A-Nationalteam versucht vorzuleben. Man holt sich Gegner, die vielleicht ein wenig außerhalb der Reichweite sind. Mit der Schweiz kommt ein sehr starkes Team. Ist das auch die Philosophie beim Frauen-Eishockey, sich stärkere Gegner zu holen, einfach nicht nur eine Standortbestimmung zu bekommen, sondern auch zu sehen, hey, hier so hoch hängt der Hammer?
Ja, also da kann man nicht viel Unterschied machen zum Männernationalteam. Es geht sicher darum, mit den Schweizern sehr gute Spiele zu haben, wo man sich wirklich auf hohem Niveau testen kann, dass man auch die Spielerinnen auf diesem Niveau spielen sieht. Andererseits ist es natürlich so, dass es dann die Möglichkeit gibt, das Spiel zu verlieren, was in der Vorbereitung aber nicht besonders wichtig ist. Es geht wirklich darum, sich anzupassen und von besseren Gegnern lernt man natürlich mehr. Wobei ich jetzt nicht unbedingt sagen würde, dass wir keine Chance haben gegen die Schweizerinnen. Also ich erwarte mir da schon ein spannendes Spiel.
Was muss passieren, dass du sagst, es war ein erfolgreiches Camp für deine U17?
Ich erwarte mir, dass alle Mädels 100% geben, dass sie an sich arbeiten, dass sie von den Coaches wichtiges Feedback bekommen, neue Inputs, an was sie auch im Verein zu Hause weiterarbeiten können. Und nachdem das erste Camp dieses Jahr ist, ist es auch für die Motivation ganz wichtig, dass sie einfach wieder als Team zusammenkommen, dass dieser Zusammenhalt da bleibt und dass sie wissen, wir arbeiten auf die Weltmeisterschaft nächstes Jahr hin.
Bin sehr gespannt, kann ich allen Eishockey-Fans nur ans Herz legen. Mitte Februar in Villach, da dreht sich dann alles um das Frauen-Eishockey. Du bist natürlich nicht nur als Expertin für Frauen-Eishockey im Podcast geladen, sondern auch als Expertin fürs Männer-Eishockey. Und da eine der ganz beliebten Kategorien und Rubriken, die es jetzt einzuführen gilt. Und du bist da ein wenig Versuchskaninchen, oft du verzeihst mir das Ganze. Es ist Award Season, nachdem ja mittlerweile auch die NHL auf Puls 24 eine große Rolle spielt und dort zigtausende gefühlt Awards vergeben werden, ziehen wir das jetzt auch ein wenig in der Bet at Home Eishockey Liga an. Habt ihr eine ganze Liste an Trophies aus der NHL geschickt, die ich dann auf die Bet at Home Eishockey League versucht habe umzumünzen? Und du hattest die wenig beneidenswerte Aufgabe, jetzt circa zur Halbzeit der Saison mir Namen zu nennen und auch Begründungen zu liefern, warum sie deiner Sicht der Dinge nach diesen Award verdienen. Eines vorweg, auch Greg Holtz und Daniel Welser werden diese Liste ausfüllen müssen, aber du schreitest natürlich wie so oft mit gutem Beispiel voran und bist die Erste, die Mid-Season Awards, wenn man so will, präsentiert möchte. Mit der Lady Bing Trophy anfangen, das ist in der NHL die Trophäe, die für die größte Sportsmanship, wenn man so will, auf und abseits des Eises verliehen wird. Hier ist es die Phil Lucas Trophäe der Zeit seiner Karriere auf und abseits des Eises mit exzellentem Beispiel vorangegangen ist. Wer ist für dich in der bisherigen Saison der Gewinner der Phil Lucas Trophy für die größte Sportsmanship?
Bisher ist es für mich Schofield, weil er einfach ein Spieler ist, der auf dem Eis und auch abseits vom Eis als Gentleman rüberkommt. Er macht sehr wenige Strafen, spielt fair, ist trotzdem ein ganz ein wichtiger Spieler für seine Mannschaft und ein richtiger Teamplayer, der seine Mannschaft auch führen kann.
Egal, wo er hinkommt, Rick Schofield immer mit vielen Toren, immer mit das produziert, immer. Ist das so ein Spieler, den du dir holst, um dann den Rest deines Teams um ihn herum aufzubauen?
Kann sicher seine Rolle sein. Also er ist ganz ein wichtiger Spieler in unterschiedlichen Aspekten für eine Mannschaft und kann dann auch die Mannschaft führen.
Wir machen weiter mit der Award-Season. In der NHL wird die Vezina Trophy an den besten Torhüter der Saison verlieren. Wir nennen das auf Österreichisch die Reinhard Divis Trophy, der Jahrhundert-Goalie, Namensgeber für den besten Tormann. Wer würde für dich eine fiktive Reinhard Divis Trophy in dieser Saison verdienen?
Für diese Trophy habe ich den Sebastian Dahm ausgewählt. Er ist auch in der Statistik ganz weit vorne mit knapp 94% Save Percentage. Also das ist schon ein unglaublicher Wert. Allein deshalb könnte man ihm diese Trophy geben. Er ist auch ein sehr souveräner Torhüter, der extrem viel spielt und seinem Team den nötigen Rückhalt gibt. Also er ist technisch gut, er hat die Erfahrung, kann meistens kontrollierte Saves machen und nur wenn notwendig Big Saves. Also er ist dann wirklich auf allen Aspekten gut ausgebildet.
Wenn du das mal versuchst, in Worte zu fassen, diese Werte auch einzuordnen. Goal Against Average von 1,6, Save Percentage von fast 94%. Wie außerirdisch ist das?
Das ist wirklich unglaublich. Also das kann man kaum in Worte fassen und ist ganz sicher ein enorm wichtiger Faktor, dass der KHC derzeit so gut ist.
Die nächste Trophy, die in der NHL auch jedes Jahr vergeben wird, ist die Calder Memorial Trophy. Die geht an den besten Newcomer und ist zwar schon ein Weilchen her, aber vor 1,5 Dekaden gab es einen Newcomer in der Liga namens Michael Grabner, der allen um die Ohren gefahren ist und dann auch in die beste Liga der Welt sich seinen Weg gebahnt hat. Wer ist für dich aktuell zu diesem Zeitpunkt der Saison der beste Newcomer? Wer würde diesen fiktiven Michi Grabner Award bekommen?
Jemand, der diese Saison neu in der Liga ist und erst 18 Jahre alt ist und wirklich sehr super Spiele abliefert, ist Sebastian Vranešić. Also er ist jetzt nicht nur in der Liga, sondern auch bei der U20-Weltmeisterschaft top gewesen, hat dort gezeigt, dass er sehr gut ist, dass er gut ausgebildet ist. Und was ihn für mich auszeichnet, ist seine professionelle Einstellung, seine gute Technik und seine Rebound-Kontrolle und sein enormer Ehrgeiz. Und dadurch sieht man auch, dass er für sich selbst sicher noch nicht am Ziel ist. Also er will sich ständig verbessern und da gibt es auch noch genug Potenzial.
In der NHL wird doch jedes Jahr der beste Verteidiger gekürt. Das wird mit der James Norris Trophy getan. Und jetzt gab es viele große Verteidiger in unserer Liga-Geschichte. Keiner hat mir persönlich so imponiert wie Matthias Tratnik. Deswegen habe ich mir erlaubt, die Verteidiger-Trophäe in der Betodom Eishockey League als Matthias Tratnik-Trophy zu bezeichnen. Schon im Wissen, dass er erst unter Pierre Paget zum Verteidiger umfunktioniert worden ist. Aber wer ist für dich aktuell in dieser Saison der beste Verteidiger?
Das war keine einfache Entscheidung, aber ich habe mich dann für Alex Wall entschieden, weil er auch offensiv und defensiv wirklich gut ist. Also er hat eine Plus-Minus-Statistik von plus 20, was auch ein enorm guter Wert ist. Und er hat auch 23 Assists diese Saison. Also er ist, wie gesagt, offensiv und defensiv ein ganz ein wichtiger Faktor für seine Mannschaft. Er ist ein guter Eislaufer, kann ansatzlos schießen und hat eine enorme Übersicht am Eis. Also er findet seine Mitspieler und dadurch auch die vielen Assists.
Natürlich wird nicht nur auf dem Eis gespielt, sondern es gibt auch Nebenschauplätze, unter anderem die Bank. Auf der Bank werkt der Trainer und auch der wird mit einem Award bedacht. In der National Hockey League ist das der Jack Adams Award und ist zwar ein wenig weiter hergeholt, aber weil er aus dieser Liga seinen Weg in die National Hockey League gefunden hat und dort auch unlängst bei den Buffalo Sabres zu sehen war, die Ralf Krüger Trophäe für den besten Coach. Welche Coaching-Leistung hat dir in der bisherigen Saison der Betodom Eishockey League am meisten imponiert?
Diese Saison war das für mich eindeutig Fehervar, also Antti Kahula, der mit seiner Mannschaft extrem überrascht hat und wirklich gut gestartet ist. Sie schießen extrem viele Tore und sie lassen auch überhaupt nicht nach. Also sie haben erst vor kurzem wieder aufgezeigt mit dem Sieg gegen Bozen mit 7 Toren, also ein richtiges Ausrufezeichen. Und sie spielen wirklich konstant über die ganze Saison gut.
Und nachdem die Partien mittlerweile auch in der Betodrom Eishockey League beendet sind und Klagenfurt sie durchgesetzt hat, ist es einerseits amtlich, dass Red Bull Salzburg die Top 5 erreicht hat und damit die Playoff-Qualifikation klar gemacht hat. Und Feuerbach führt erneut deutlich 5:2 gegen den VSV. Also Antti Kaula, wahrscheinlich völlig zu Recht, dein bisheriger Trainer der Saison. Eine Trophy, die fehlt uns noch. Die Hart Memorial Trophy, die geht an den wertvollsten Spieler der Saison. Und nachdem er auch zum Jahrhundertspieler in Österreich gewählt worden ist, ist das Äquivalent zur Hart Memorial Trophy in Österreich natürlich die Sepp Puschnigg Trophäe. Wer ist für dich bisher der beste Spieler in dieser Saison?
Also seine Statistik haben wir schon genannt, die wirklich extrem gut ist. Und es ist auch auf dieser Position Sebastian Dahm erneut in der Wertung, weil er wirklich seine Mannschaft gut im Spiel halten kann. Und meiner Meinung nach auch ein Torhüter ein ganz ein wichtiger Faktor ist für den Erfolg. Und deshalb hat er diese Trophy verdient.
Das sind Trophys, an denen sich die beiden anderen Experten noch die Zähne ausbeißen werden müssen, dürfen, werden wir sehen. Aber überall schlüssig argumentiert und bin ja sehr dankbar, dass du diesen Blödsinn immer mit mir mitmachst. Möchte ganz zum Schluss noch einen kurzen Ausblick wagen auf den nächsten Puls 24 Hockey Matchday Villach gegen Innsbruck. Wie wichtig sind diese Bonuspunkte, um die es in dieser Begegnung dann auch gehen wird?
Ganz wichtige Punkte, die es dann für die Qualification Round braucht. Also die Top 5 sind ja jetzt fixiert und dann geht es wirklich um diese entscheidenden Punkte, um dann möglichst weit vorne zu sein in der Qualification Round.
Sind sehr gespannt. Ab 16.10 Uhr am kommenden Sonntag gibt's den vollen Hockey Matchday wieder. Zuvor natürlich wie immer den NHL Matchday und nachdem dann auch konsequent weitergespielt wird, wird dann schon am Sonntag oder die Woche drauf am Sonntag wieder Zwischenrunden bzw. Platzierungsrunden und Qualifikationsrunden Eishockey gespielt. Dir in jedem Fall vielen lieben Dank für die Einschätzung. Wie immer eine Freude, deinen Ausführungen lauschen zu dürfen.
Danke dir.
Das war's mit Hockey O'Clock, dieses Mal in Folge 34 und das bedeutet aktuell auch eine kleine Pause. Hockey O'Clock verabschiedet sich in einen kleinen zweiwöchigen Winterschlaf. Während dieser zwei Wochen gibt es nochmal alle Folgen des Philipp bzw. Robert Lukas Spezials und heute in drei Wochen gibt es dann wieder frisches Podcast-Futter. Freue mich auf euch. Bis dann.
Hockey O'Clock mit Martin Pfander wurde präsentiert von Bet at Home, dem offiziellen Ligasponsor der Ice Hockey League. Hol dir jetzt deinen Eishockey-Quotenboost auf Bet at Home. Unsere Liga, dein Spiel.